I am going to call the House and Senate Tax Conference Committee to order. And Mr. Anderson, would you please call? Mr. Peterson, please call the roll.
Chair Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
Representative Davids.
Present.
Representative Herr.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
Present.
Chair Nelson.
Present.
Senator Weber.
Present.
Senator Rust. Senator Bach.
Here.
Senator Gazelka.
Here.
10 members present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. So welcome to the Tax Conference Committee of the House and Senate. And as I look around the room here, I see a lot of Tax Conference Committee experience. And so with that, I think it's going to set a very high bar for all of us to get something that's going to make a real difference in the lives of folks around the state of Minnesota. And I especially want to thank Governor Walz and Speaker Hortman and Majority Leader Miller for their leadership, for giving us the resources to be able to really make a real and meaningful difference in people's lives. And I'm confident that we can do that. If you remember last year and 2 years before, when we had a divided government, and back a couple years ago, it was the only divided government in the nation, and now I think we're one of two, we were able to come together and we've put tax bills together, and I think tax bills that have really benefited the state. So I want to thank you very much, Chair Nelson. We have two strong bills. The House bill is a very strong bill with strong priorities, and the Senate tax bill is a strong bill with strong priorities. And by putting those together, we're going to make an even better bill between the two, and that will be the goal. So before we go to introductions, again, thank you, Chair Nelson, and allow you a few minutes to for some introductory comments.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Well, it is great to finally get together again and bring these tax bills together. I really appreciate the great the expertise around this table and the honest brokers around this table. I am so appreciative of looking ahead to the good work that we're going to do. We do come at an unusual time this year in that we have over a $9.25 billion surplus, over $10 billion as those revenues have continued to come in. And because of the good work of those who came before me, we now have that $2.5 billion surplus as well. So, and I know we share the same priorities as far as empowering Minnesotans, sparking economic growth, and seeing our state prosper. So I definitely look forward as we move forward into taking our bills and getting them into that one bill. The difference this year, however, is we have a much shorter time frame. So we're going to work fast, but we're going to be very careful and respectful and thoughtful as we move forward. So, Chair Marquardt, I look forward to our work together again this year.
Very good. Thank you very much, Chair Nelson. And what I'd like to first do is introduction of members. And what I'd like you to say is just what district you represent, and then how many years you've been on a tax conference committee, if you can remember. So I'll start. I'm Representative Paul Marquardt, represent District 4B, which is all our parts of Becker, Clay, and Norman County, and I think this is my eighth year on a tax conference committee. We'll go down the list there. Chair Davids.
Greg Davids, District 28B, Fillmore and Houston Counties. Tax chair, 6 years, tax conference committees. Long time. I think since before baseball, actually. Probably.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Lislegard, 6B, a good portion of the Iron Range, and this is my second, but I would like to say that I'm truly humbled to be at this table with these distinguished people with all your experience and knowledge, and I look forward to this opportunity.
Representative Cheryl Joachim, Property Tax Division Chair for the second year and Conference Committee for the second year. Represent Hopkins and St. Louis Park.
Representative Khalid Vanghur is 64A in St. Paul, and this is my second year on the Conference Committee.
Very good. Chair Nelson, work our way down that way.
Chair Nelson from Rochester, represent Olmsted County in the legislature. This is my second year on the Conference Committee, my sixth year on the Tax Committee.
Tom Bach, I represent Senate District 3, which is most of the Arrowhead region of northern Minnesota. I have to call it the district where Minnesota loves to play. So if you've ever been to the North Shore or the Boundary Waters or Voyageurs National Park, you've been to my district. Spent 4 years here as the chair of the Senate Tax Committee when Representative Lincheski chaired the committee in the House. Chair Marquardt was on the Conference Committee those 4 years, as was Representative Davids. And been around this process a long, long time. My first tax conference committee was 1995. So, but looking forward to be here. Senator Rest was on that same conference committee with me when we were in the House. So, looking forward to getting reacquainted with friends from the House.
State Senator Bill Weber, I am from Laverne. My Senate district is Senate District 22. I'm in the very southwest corner of the state with 72 miles of shared border with South Dakota and 60 with Iowa. When my new district shows up, it'll have 72 with each state, to be honest about it. We've been in a corner of the state where we've seen taxpayers and taxpaying businesses leave our state for decades. And that greatly influences my view of the tax picture in Minnesota. I've been in the legislature for 10 years. This is my second year as Property Tax Subcommittee Chair and on the Property Tax Conference Committee, or on the Tax Conference Committee.
Paul Gazelka, Senate District 9, and I served on taxes, I think started my third year going forward. I think this is my third time on the Tax Conference Committee. I was aiming to be the tax chair, but suddenly a better opening came up. But even then, I wanted to serve on taxes. I think, Tom, you sort of led the way. Stay connected. And this is my favorite of all committees, and Tax Conference Committee is my favorite of all.
My name is Ann Rest, and I represent Senate District 45, new District 43. And I have a contest going with Senator Swazinski, who likes to tell puns. And I naturally mix metaphors. And so we have a contest going as to who can outdo the other. And I started with, I may be old, but my brain operates on both lobes. I've been on the Tax Conference Committee since 1988.
Well, thank you very much, members, for that. I then would like staff to introduce themselves, starting with Mr. Peterson.
Eric Peterson, Committee Legislative Assistant to the Property Tax Division, and this is my second year with the Tax Conference Committee.
Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. I've participated in a Tax Conference Committee since 2006.
Sean Williams from House Research. I staff income taxes and the property tax refund programs.
Jared Swanson with House Research. I staff property taxes and state aids.
Chris Klayman, House Research. I staff business taxes, the corporate franchise tax, the estate tax, and also this year I'm staffing sales taxes.
We have two House researchers who are on Zoom, Ms. Schill, Mr. Cope.
Good afternoon, members. Kathy Schill, House Fiscal Staff. I do tax aids and credits and various other lines. Thank you.
Mr. Cope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Justin Cope. I'm with House Research. This is my first session, and I handle tax increment financing and a few other tax issues.
Thank you. Ms. Cervenic.
My name is Polly Cervenic. I'm the committee administrator for the House Taxes Committee and the Property Tax Division, and this is also my first year on the Taxes World and Conference Committee.
Senator Nelson, you want to introduce Senate staff, please?
Thank you. Ms. Maddie Hoy, my committee legislative assistant. And then we have, I'll let the staff introduce themselves, and we also have two on Zoom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Jay Wellms. I'm the Senate Fiscal Analyst for the Taxes Committee and the Subcommittee on Property Taxes.
Mr. Chair, members, Nora Pollack, Senate Counsel for Income and Sales Taxes.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Eric Sylvia, and I staff the Property Tax, TIF, and Mining and Minerals areas.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Bjorn Arneson. Do state aids and property tax modeling for the Senate Taxes Committees.
Thank you very much, staff, for those introductions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Weber.
Property tax CLA, Lamont Pankinen behind me here. So.
Very good.
And we also have a researcher and my committee administrator online.
Oh,
via Zoom.
Very good. And we do have one more researcher back here, Kelly Cabanati for Republican House Research.
So I don't know if my Mr. Steinhoff, are you there? Or Mr. Mickelberg? You will all get to know them very well in the next few days. Dan Mickelberg is our researcher, and Brian Steinhoff is our committee administrator. So,
well, thank you very much. I think we've got a really strong team here. So good things ahead. At this time, I would like to introduce Commissioner Doty for some remarks. And on behalf of the Conference Committee, thank you very much for all the work that the Department of Revenue provides us and revenue estimates, and a lot of times in a very short time frame, and all the input and contributions you make to us putting our tax bills together during the year. So thank you so much for being here, and Commissioner Doty.
Thank you, and good evening, Chairs Marquardt and Nelson, and members of the Conference Committee. For the record, my name is Robert Doty, and I'm the Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And before I start my remarks, I do want to just take a moment and introduce my team that's here. They are the unsung heroes of what happens at the Department of Revenue. So first I want to start with our Legislative Director, Joanna Bayers, who's back here, and our assistant commission, one of our assistant commissioners, John Cloxie, is also back here. We also have two individuals from our legal department, Margaret Reisdorf and Dexter Wilson. I believe they're back here. And then finally, our director of tax research, Eric Ouellette, and I think he's over here someplace. But anyway, there's Eric. Okay. So that is our team that we have here today. So again, thank you, Chair, and for allowing me to take some time to share with you my perspective about the bills that are before you today and will be discussed this week. We have also shared a letter with the committee to provide additional details on these proposals to supplement my remarks today. The tax bill is a fundamental part of the state's budget, and while this is a supplemental budget year, this conference committee has the opportunity to provide needed investments to help support Minnesotans and maintain fiscal stability for future budget years. The tax bill provides a remarkable opportunity to provide relief to the middle class, working families, students, farmers, and small businesses, while also investing in public safety, health care, and education. Additionally, this bill gives us the opportunity to adopt the federal changes for businesses and individuals enacted since our tax statutes were last updated in 2019. Federal conformity provides an investment in Minnesota's tax system to ensure that it is stable, predictable, and less complex. Without a federal update, our code requires taxpayers and tax professionals to track complex adjustments and increase compliance costs. The goal of this conference committee is to come to resolution on the bills before you. And we will be encouraging on behalf of the governor and administration resolutions that will improve the lives of Minnesotans and win the support for enactment. I believe this committee can accomplish all of that in the time allotted. When Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan proposed their supplemental budget in January, they put people at the center of their budget, investing in students, workers, communities, and small businesses that propel our economy forward by prioritizing three areas. One is expanding economic opportunities for all Minnesotans. Number two, supporting children and families. And finally, protecting Minnesotans' health, safety, and well-being. At the heart of the Walz-Flanagan budget is expanding economic opportunity for Minnesotans. Over the last 2 years, Minnesotans have worked together to keep the economy moving. That's why the state has a historic surplus. As a result, the governor believes direct relief for Minnesotans through a one-time payment up to $1,000 is the best way to give part of that historic surplus back to Minnesotans. The governor's tax bill also includes important changes to support Minnesota families. We have all seen the increased cost for raising children between food, diapers, and childcare. Minnesota families need relief. The governor's proposal includes important changes to refundable income tax credits that Minnesota families rely on, namely the Minnesota's Child Independent Care Credit and the K-12 Education Credit. We have also heard from local governments that are facing increased costs to provide essential services like public safety and clean water, which is why the governor proposed $100 million for a new public safety aid program and $22 million for soil and water conservation districts. These investments will support local projects, drive economic growth, keep Minnesotans healthy and safe, and protect our state's beauty and natural resources. In the bucket of supporting children and families, in recognition of the challenges Minnesota parents face in paying for quality, affordable childcare, we are appreciative that the Senate, House, and Governor's bills all include an expansion of the Dependent Care Credit, which will lower taxes for more Minnesotans. All bills include an update to the income threshold at which the credit starts to phase out. The Governor and the House make additional investments to increase the amount of the credit to provide more meaningful relief. Property tax refunds. The House bill also takes a new approach to the renter's credit by converting it to an income tax credit instead of the current standalone program. The current program provides a property refund to over 300,000 households throughout the state. This new approach would allow more renters to qualify for the program. We appreciate the House and Senate including a provision from the governor's bill to increase the income limit and reduce the ownership requirements for the senior citizen property tax deferral program. This important program allows more seniors to age in place. Direct payments. Much like the governor's bill, the House bill includes a rebate that would go directly to Minnesotans later this year. The governor is strongly supportive of these types of direct payments. While the amount and mechanism is different than the governor's proposal, we are glad to see the inclusion of the income tax rebate for children. Working families. These bills include the governor's measure to expand eligibility for the refundable K-12 education credit and update the measure of income to simplify the calculation of the credit. The credit helps Minnesota families pay for school-related expenses such as fees for instruction outside the regular school day or school year, expenses for textbooks or instructional materials, and transportation costs paid to others. Under the bucket of expanding economic opportunities for all Minnesotans, start with the Angel Tax Credit. The Senate, House, and Governor all included additional funds for the Angel Tax Credit, which can provide critical investments in achieving our shared goal of expanding economic opportunities for all Minnesotans. Investing in local government. The House includes a temporary version of the governor's proposal to streamline the sales and use tax exemption for buildings, construction, or reconstruction materials, supplies, and equipment for buildings and facilities used primarily by local governments and nonprofits. This change will allow more projects to take advantage of the current sales tax exemption. The Senate bill would only extend this toward school district projects. Rising inflation costs have made construction more expensive across the state for local governments, and this exemption would be a valuable tool to make in making new construction projects more affordable for property taxpayers. The department hopes that any conference committee agreement would include this provision and allow school districts, nonprofits, and local governments to all benefit. We appreciate the House also included Governor Walz's Soil and Water Conservation District aid. This aid will ensure these conservation districts have a reliable funding source to continue protecting Minnesota's natural resources and ultimately prove beneficial to Minnesota's agricultural community. The bills also include many sales and use tax exemptions that support our units of local government across the state of Minnesota. Property tax aids and credits. We appreciate the House including the expansion to the homestead property tax refund. The governor proposes expanding the homestead credit to taxpayers with I-10s, and we appreciate the inclusion in the House bill. These refunds target low and middle income households and those on fixed incomes and are an important program for helping to reduce the costs of housing and shore up taxpayers' ability to meet basic needs. Between the three bills, there are six new aid programs and modifications to four other current aids. The governor and lieutenant governor propose new public safety aid and soil and water conservation district aid. The House creates a new affordable housing aid program, stronger community aid, and the Senate proposes two transitional aid programs to assist communities seeing tax-based reductions from the 4D changes in their bill and communities facing power plant closures. We appreciate the inclusion of the updated local government aid formula contained in the House bill. We know this is an important tool to assist our government partners and help reduce property taxes. We look forward to having this conversation in conference committee. This formula update, along with the increases to LGA and CPA, are critical lifelines for many of our local government partners. The House also addresses the concern of local governments with large portions of PILT lands by increasing the rate. These important investments will make sure cities can provide essential services to their residents. The state's response to federal tax changes. The department appreciates the work the committees have done on the area of federal conformity. We all agree on the importance of responding to the federal tax changes enacted since our tax statutes were last updated in 2019. Individual taxpayers, CPAs, and businesses have all expressed the need to update our tax code to reduce complexity and compliance costs. The House and Senate bills generally adopt the governor's approach to update the general conformity date and provide important conformity for individuals and businesses. Adopting the annual federal changes for individual and business income provides simplicity for tax filing in Minnesota and ease of tax administration. We've had opportunity to talk with lawmakers, nonpartisan staff, and stakeholders throughout session about how to efficiently address conformity for taxpayers given the multiple number of federal tax changes that have been enacted. These bills include the approach aimed at both getting our state tax code in alignment with the Internal Revenue Code and simplifying filing for individuals and businesses. I would like to take this opportunity to voice some concerns regarding some proposals included in the House and Senate bills. Social Security benefits subtraction. Both the Senate and the House include different approaches to increase the exclusion from tax for Social Security benefits. The governor supported an increase in the exemption that was enacted in 2019. As a result of those changes, Social Security recipients already pay only a portion of their pay tax only on a portion of their Social Security income. After the federal exclusion and Minnesota subtraction, about 53% of recipients pay no state tax on benefits. The Senate's approach to exempt all benefits, regardless of ability to pay, benefits the state's highest earners. The House approach provides more fiscal restraint by focusing the subtraction on middle-income recipients. Pass-through entity tax. Both the House and the Senate bill include changes to the pass-through entity tax that was enacted last session and began in tax year 2021. As you may recall, the pass-through entity tax was enacted as a workaround to the temporary federal cap on state and local tax deductions for individuals. The federal cap is set to sunset in 2025. We appreciate working with stakeholders to make most of the changes administratable and clear for taxpayers. We do, however, want to share our concern with one change included in this language. We do not support the expansion of the calculation of entity income to allow resident allocation of income. Under current Minnesota law, entities apportion their income based on the amount of Minnesota-sourced income. This reflects the business activity in the state. The proposed expansion would allow tax to be allocated based on residency of the individual partners. This is inconsistent with entity taxation and is not fairly apportioned. The entity would allocate 100% of income based on Minnesota residency of owner, including income sourced to other states. This would allow states of residence and states with source jurisdiction over the same pass-through entity income to dispute tax allocation. It is unknown how this might impact the credit for tax paid in other states. New Market Tax Credit. The Senate bill provides a new program, the New Markets Tax Credit. If this provision moves forward, we would like to work with the committee on administrative concerns with both from both the department and DEED for implementation of this new program. This proposal would call on the agencies to coordinate to provide tax credits for equity investments in active, low-income community businesses and is based on a federal New Markets Tax Credit. While we encourage the idea of investing in low-income community businesses, the agencies have significant administrative concerns for this complex new program. Opposition. 529 plans for private school tuition and increase in K-12 subtraction. The Senate bill conforms to the federal treatment of Section 529 college plans to allow tax benefits for K-12 private school tuition payments and increases the K-12 subtraction amount by 50%. The governor opposes prioritizing benefits like these during a time when we should be funding the needs of our public schools. The estate tax increased exemption. The Senate bill provides relief for the wealthiest Minnesotans through changes to the estate tax by allowing a larger amount of the estate to go untaxed. In some cases, this portability proposal may double the amount of the exclusion. The governor opposes this exclusion to the estate tax exemption and urges the conference to continue to put everyday Minnesotans at the center of this bill by investing in students, workers, communities, and small businesses that move our community, our economy forward. The state general levy phase out. The repeal of the statewide general levy will cost the state $1.5 billion a biennium once it is phased out, and that is not reflected on the spreadsheet since it falls outside of the budget window. Repealing the state general levy this way would cut off sources of investment for public services that would benefit all Minnesotans and is fiscally irresponsible. As we start conference committee, the Department of Revenue would like to reaffirm our commitment to making sure policies included in the final tax bill can be administered well for taxpayers you intend to benefit with these policy choices. We will continue to share policy and administrative concerns as we continue our review of the bill and the amendments adopted. We also want to thank the House and Senate for including the Department's policy and technical bill in their tax bill. These provisions allow Minnesota's tax code to be administered efficiently and effectively. Additionally, as we move forward and put together a final bill, we will need to make sure we have the resources needed to implement these changes. These bills require significant system updates, and in order to administer and update the tax code for these changes, the department will need additional resources. In closing, I want to close by taking a minute to thank you. Not only to you, the conference committee, but to all the tax committee members and staff for your work over the past several months. I think it's safe to say that we don't always agree on the best way to move Minnesota's tax code forward, and that's okay. That's one of the benefits of a representative democracy, and it's the main reason you were all here today to iron out those differences. However, what I do think we can all agree on is we have a historic opportunity here to provide some real tax relief to Minnesotans at a time when they could certainly use it. especially to the middle class, working families, students, farmers, and small businesses, all while investing in public safety, health care, and education. Last, but certainly not least, I'd like to thank the staff at the Department of Revenue for the countless hours they dedicate to the people of this state and to our mission of working together to fund the future for all of Minnesota. These are true public servants, and I am so very grateful for their work every day. With that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Doty, thank you for those comments, and we look forward to working closely with you and the department and the governor's office as we move forward.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, members, we are going to go to the spreadsheets, and so if Mr. Wilms and Ms. Templin could go to the testifying tables. The intention here is to try to wrap everything up between the spreadsheets and the side-by-sides by 7:30. So we're going to try to limit the spreadsheet to about 30 minutes. Members, you know, I think most of us know much of the details. I've asked both Mr. Wilms and Ms. Templin not to deal with, like, interactions, those small, like, if that's okay with members, and then give us more time on the side-by-side. So thank you, first of all, for your preparation of all this. This is all great information. So I don't know who wants to start, and members will kind of take a section by section, and then if you have any questions, we'll entertain questions at that time. So Ms. Templin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Cynthia Templin, House Fiscal Staff. My colleague, Kathy Schill, will also be presenting the House property tax side of the spreadsheet. We discussed, fiscal staff discussed both House and Senate to approach the spreadsheet walkthrough by going through the House section in its entirety and then the Senate section in its entirety. And so we will proceed as like that. And in addition, the great Ms. Cirkvenic is also sharing the screen, and you can follow along on your screen. Thank you very much. And I will start with the summary page. The approach we're going to take in this presentation so that in the interest of time is to kind of identify the fiscal impact for fiscal provisions in each omnibus bill and where to find the provisions in the joint tracking sheet. The summary page, as you can see, for the House bill, for tax policy, there are total general fund revenue reductions of $1.477 billion in fiscal 22 and 23, and in fiscal 24 and 25, in that biennium, $1.629 billion. For property taxes, in the interest of time, I'll just cover these pretty quickly. You can see on line 7 the total expenditures in fiscal 22 and 23 and the tails. And then for the bottom line, net impact to the general fund in fiscal 22 and 23 for the House bill is $1.644 billion on line 8. And you can see the corresponding general fund impact in the tails. Okay, I'll just continue with the House side. Lines 10 through 20, it shows the non-general fund impact for the House provisions. Turning the page to page 2. At the top, I just want to direct your attention to lines 1 through 6. These lines show the total general fund changes to the House tax bill. And I just went over them on the summary page, but they're at the top. They're the same. Moving on in the spreadsheet and continuing on page 2, federal conformity in the spreadsheet for income taxes and corporate taxes is covered on pages 2 and 4. But very generally, I just want to kind of summarize the House's federal conformity approach rather than go through line per line. Basically, the House has a very similar position on federal conformity to the governor and the Senate. The House also does the catch-up provision
that retroactively adopts to most changes in federal law and provides a mechanism to make an adjustment as an addition or a subtraction on the 22 income tax and corporate tax return. In the House version, it's slightly different. There are some differences in that it allows taxpayers to amend more conformity provisions from prior years. And as a result, there are provisions that are slightly higher in the House approach. And you can see them on the spreadsheet as being higher because it shows full conformity in the descriptor of each line item. In addition, the House's position is slightly different from the governor and the Senate because the House does not conform to two retroactive charitable contribution deductions, one of which one provision is on line 32. The House does conform to a retroactive provision in tax year 20 for the exclusion of employer student loan payments, and the governor and the Senate do not conform. And so those are the areas of the differences in federal conformity. Moving on to page 3. Page 3 shows the bulk of the House's position for changes to income tax law. I want to direct your attention to line 57. I'm just going to highlight a couple of the big items. In terms of fiscal impact, that is the renter's income tax credit that replaces the renter's credit on line 57. The savings for the renter's credit will be, it's shown on the spreadsheet on line 58 in brackets, but it's also covered in the property tax expenditure side.
So, Ms. Templin, because it's kind of tough to kind of figure this out on this renter's credit just from that. So what is the reason for the $373 million cost on the first? There's a double payment, isn't that correct? On the first, in the Mr. 2023?
Chair, yes, I believe you're on line 57. Under fiscal 23, the 372.6, I believe it's a difference in timing. The income tax refund would be a revenue loss in fiscal 23, and the cost would be shifted into fiscal 23, and that's why you see the cost. And I think when we get to the property tax side of this spreadsheet, it will become more clear the issues about between the timing of the income tax return and the property tax on renter's credit.
So if I understand this right, it would be in this August of 22, they would get a refund as current law. But when they now apply for their 22 rent, property tax paid rent, would then occur during the property taxes from January through April. So that they're both in the same fiscal year.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Michelle.
Yes, that is correct. What we're showing is the difference between the forecast and what is included with this change on the spreadsheet. So the 372.6 million is that payment that would happen 6 months earlier. Yeah. Plus, also remember, there is an expansion within the eligibility because we're going to adjusted gross income. So it's a little heftier than what you see in the cost savings for fiscal 24 and beyond. That's why those two numbers are not totally canceling each other, because you have two things going on. You have the fiscal 23 impact for moving that up 6 months, but on the underlying parameter also is greater eligibility.
Thank you, Michelle. And the greater eligibility isn't expanding or including change in law to include new people. What the Department of Revenue anticipates is that the participation rate will go up by moving it to the income tax.
Correct.
And that's part of it. And then the other part is moving from household income to adjusted gross income.
Adjusted gross income, correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, to clarify too, that $372.6 million is not a payment or an expenditure. It would be a revenue reduction because it would be an income tax credit.
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Okay. Moving along the spreadsheet, on the same page three, another item that I want to highlight is on page, or is on line 71, 70 and 71, and that is the Great Start Child and Dependent Care Credit provisions. On line 72 of the spreadsheet, moving down, you can see the cost of the $325 rebate credit for children under age 17. And then on line 82, the House also has a one-time provision for an income tax subtraction for the unemployment for unemployment insurance for tax year 21 only. And on line 83, the House also, as Commissioner Doty mentioned, has a Social Security subtraction with a modified phase-out. And that, you can see the cost again on line 83. Turning the page to page four, we went over the conformity provisions very generally, so we can, again, turn to page five. And on page five, lines 155 and 157 show the two corporate tax provisions for the historic rehabilitation credit. The House's position is to repeal, is to extend the sunset for the credit and to change the five-year payment to a lump sum payment for the credit. And there is also a COVID business assistance subtraction for grant payments received by businesses. Moving on to the sales tax section on page five. Page five, lines 185 through 209 show all the changes to sales taxes. And just very generally, there are the House on line 187 has a temporary sales tax construction exemption for nonprofits and local governments. And unlike the governor's provision, which is ongoing, the House's provision is available for 24 months. It allows the exemption for 24 months with the ability to get a refund for 24 months. And the fiscal impact of that temporary exemption is just for fiscal 22 and 23. In addition, the House also has several standalone construction exemptions for other entities, and they're listed on the spreadsheet. And one other item I want to highlight is the House also expands some existing exemptions for current law exemptions. For example, the capital equipment exemption on line 194 is expanded to include restaurant and food services, and you can see the fiscal impact listed on the spreadsheet. And then, in the interest of time, I'm going to turn to page six, and you can see all the other provisions for estate tax, the state general levy, and other tax revenue. One item I want to just mention as well is on line 328, the House has a provision that is similar to an item that was enacted last year where the June acceleration requirement is repealed for cigarette, tobacco, liquor, and mortgage and deed taxes. And it's only repealed, and it's contingent on a positive November 22 forecast balance. And that provision doesn't show up in the spreadsheet because it is a contingent repeal. And that concludes the general fund tax policy revenue side. And I'll turn to my colleague. Oh, actually, I'll turn to my colleague, Michelle, for property taxes.
All right, Ms. Shills. Thank you, Ms. Templin.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Kathy Shillhouse, fiscal staff, and I will be going over pages 7 through 11. These are the tax aids, credits, and refunds. And as a reminder, positive numbers are program expenditures here. Negative numbers are cost savings. The general fund summary shown on lines 1 through 4 is the same as what you saw on the cover page of this document, lines 2, 3, and 7. The remaining lines on these pages show 52 change items for the House and 20 change items for the Senate, which are all grouped into 5 different categories. The first being the homestead credit state refund, second, renter and targeting property tax refund, third, local aids, fourth, property tax credits, and 5, a category of other. To continue with the identification of fiscal provisions for each of the bills and where to find them on the joint tracking sheet, here are 2 more observations, pretty much following the general format that Ms. Templin already started using. First of all, there are only 4 items that are the same. On line 40, disabled veterans homestead market value exclusion, the application extension. Line 41, airport property special property tax exemption. Line 42, Indian tribe owned property tax exemption extension. And line 58, special targeting PTR changes. There are 3 similar items. Once again, within the first category of homestead credit state refund, these are the senior citizens property tax deferral, lines 19 and 20. Lines 23 and 24, the energy storage system exemption. And then lines 25 and 26 are the cooperative utility distribution line. Now, as we continue reviewing the House provisions, the columns in the middle of the page, it's easier to share highlights by biennium. For example, for fiscal 22 and 23, with the proposed spending of $167.7 million, is comprised of, and these are on pages 9 and 10, so just take a look at the fiscal 22-23 columns. There are 4 new one-time aids. Line 75 has career workforce academies. These are county grants. Line 76 is county pandemic business aid. Line 77 is county pandemic rental assistance. And then line 110 on page 10 is the polar vortex rebate to municipal utilities. And then again, there are 2 new aids that begin in fiscal 23 and then continue into fiscal years 24 and 25 and then beyond. And this is also on page 10. Line 93 is the Soil and Water Conservation District aid. And then line 109, you'll see the Workforce Affordable Homeownership Account. And then as we move to fiscal years 24 and 25, so you'll need to go back up to page 7, please. Proposed net spending is approximately a cost savings of $30 million. And how did we get there? It's a combination of a number of items, and I will highlight the major items in each category. So beginning on line 8, you'll see the homeowner PTR program modifications. And then line 9, as Commissioner Doty mentioned, this is an expansion of to eligible homeowners for homestead status for the individual taxpayer identification number. And then there are various cost savings from interactions, some of those seemingly large from aid increases on the next page. There we go. Okay, so this whole area, lines 43 through 53, are those interactions that you can see where they are. Okay, the next subset, let's continue on to page 9. You'll see line 55 is where we begin the renter PTR, and the item that mentioned by both Chair Marquardt and my colleague Cynthia Templin is on line 57. This is the repeal of the renter's credit. It's sunsetting after rent paid in 2022. And so that's the complement of the new tax credit. Continuing down the page, beginning on line 62 is the aid section. And on line 63, you'll see the LGA formula change and appropriation increase. On line 73, similarly, you'll see county program aid, the appropriation increase there. On line 79 through 83 is the new county local affordable housing aid. And you can see how it is sectioned into appropriations for counties, cities, and then a small amount going for MHFA and distribution in that manner. Line 94 on page 10 is the increase in PILT payments and also evaluation report. And then on line 95 is the change in the school district equalization aid, the local option revenue. Moving to the next section with property tax credit changes, the bulk of this change is attributable to line 97. Yes, line, excuse me, 90, where is it? There it is, 101. And this is the expansion of the school building bond agricultural credit to 85%. And then the remaining section in the other category, starting on line 108, includes those items we previously mentioned, the workforce housing and the polar vortex aids. And then one last note, following on page 11, two last notes. First of all, we do have an impact that is also complementary to the, and you'll see it on line 117, the aid payment shift for the budget reserve. As Ms. Templin had mentioned, there's an expansion there, and there would be an expansion if monies are available, that contingent amount for paying down aids, and there's on our very last page, we go into some of that detail. And then finally, on lines 124 through 130, these show subtotals for each category of spending. This information is helpful when comparing the fiscal impact of change items among groups. And so you can see where most of the change is happening, or perhaps no change is happening, not only biennially, but within each category. Here ends the presentation on the tax aids and credits portion of the spreadsheet.
So thank you very much, Ms. Schill. So that completes the House spreadsheet. Mr. Wilms, please begin with the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We'll begin on page 1 again, showing the Senate columns at the far right of the page. Line 6 shows the tax policy changes, shows an estimated reduction in FY22-23 of approximately $3.4 billion, and then in the second biennium, $5.2 billion estimated revenue reduction. On line 7, it shows additional property tax expenditures of $140,000 approximately in the first biennium and $14.9 million in the second biennium. Various non-general fund changes, which I think will, you know, become clear during the walkthrough of the language, so we'll skip ahead now to page 2. Page two begins with the individual income tax conformity changes. As my colleague, Ms. Templin, indicated, they're very similar between House, Governor, and Senate. The Senate proposal, in the interest of time, will be described as saying that it's identical to the governor's approach on conformity. It includes the catch-up and all the related provisions of that. So having said that, we can move now to page three, which shows other change items included in the tax policy section of the Senate omnibus bill. So beginning on line 77, an additional $7 million allocation in tax year 22 for the Angel Investment Credit. Moving down to line 80 shows a similar approach to the pass-through entity tax modifications. And then moving ahead then to line 88, 89, and 90, these lines comprise the bulk of the tax policy changes contained within the Senate omnibus tax bill. It's approximately 96% of the revenue reductions are contained on these lines. The first line, line 88, shows the first bracket rate reduction from 5.35 to 2.8%. That would be effective in tax year 22 and would result in decreases to approximately 2.4 million taxpayers for an average reduction of $760 per taxpayer. Line 89 shows the interaction between the subtraction for Social Security. The Senate proposes a full subtraction of Social Security income, which, in addition to several other base modifications, results in the rate cut effect being slightly less expensive, hence the positive numbers showing the revenue gain offset. The 100% subtraction of Social Security income would also be effective in tax year 22. It would affect approximately 406,000 filers that would see an average reduction of $1,253. Moving on to line 91, this shows the modification to the phase-out threshold of the Child Independent Care Credit. Currently, it phases out at about 53,000 approximately, and this would raise that threshold to where the state credit phases out to 70,000. Line 92 shows the proposed modifications to the K-12 credit, the switch from household income to FAGI as the basis, and then an increase in the phase-out threshold, which is currently at 33,500. It is raised to 50,000 and then indexed for beginning in tax year 23. That results in approximately $5.7 million in tax reductions in the first year. Line 93 shows the Senate approach to increasing this K-12 Senate subtraction. So this is the subtraction available for those who, due to income limits, do not qualify for the K-12 credit. So the subtraction amounts are increased by 100%. And again, that proposal, which is not indexed under current law, begins to be indexed in tax year 23. The Senate also includes two credits that are new. One is a credit for preceptors, that's on line 94. And then the Senate also includes a credit for parental leave expenditures either made directly by the employer or for insurance coverage for that employee. There's a little bit of a differential rate between the credit, whether or not they pay it directly or pay for insurance, which will be detailed during the language walkthrough. I should also note line 97 only captures a portion of the expense. The remaining item budget effect is tracked under the corporate side. Moving back up slightly, 95 and 96, we see subtractions for eligible public safety pension income. Line 96 shows the subtraction for earnings on nuclear decommissioning trust fund income. Both of those provisions, you'll note, have footnotes, and throughout the document, you'll see there are various footnotes where greater context is provided. For information contained in the revenue estimates, that's not adequately captured just by looking at the effects in the forecast windows. Line 98 shows the R&D credit increase. Currently, 10% of expenses up to $2 million are reimbursed at 10%, and then past that, in the second tier, it's reimbursed at 4%. This proposal would increase it by a quarter percentage point, beginning in tax year 22. Moving on to the next page, line 4, We see, as previously discussed, the New Markets tax credit. That would begin in line 23, but as is footnoted, the majority of the effects occur outside the forecast window. Line 100 shows the repeal of the 529 plan amount addition under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act conformity from prior years. The amounts used for private school tuition were required to be added back into income. This shows, you know, a conformity adjacent proposal that would remove that repeal, or would repeal that addition. Finally, we get to line, 102 and 116, various interactions, which we won't go into in detail. And then line 120 shows the subtotal for the other individual income tax changes. So these are all the changes, not including conformity. So as we see, approximately $3.3 billion in FY22-23 and $5.1 billion in FY24-25. Lines 130 through 152 on page 4 detail the corporate portion of the federal conformity proposal in the Senate omnibus. Most are identical to what was previously discussed here today, so we'll skip over those components and move to page 5. Beginning with line 156, this shows the Senate proposal on the historic structure rehabilitation credit. Unlike the House proposal, this doesn't modify the expense timing, so it still keeps the five-year expensing framework for a total cost of $7.6 million in revenue reductions to the general fund in FY22-23, and then $32.2 million in FY24-25. This also has a footnote because the full effect occur outside the forecast window, but they're approximately between $30 and $40 million annually outside the forecast window. Line 158 shows the extra component of the parental leave expenditures that I discussed previously. Line 159 also shows the corporate effect of the modification to the R&D credit. So for the subtotal corporate tax changes, line 170, we see an estimated reduction of $8.9 million in the first biennium. Moving on to the sales and use taxes, most of those are self-explanatory by the descriptor. What I will say is that line 152, the North Metro range, is the same as is carried in the House. And then the two similar provisions included are line 203, the exemption for ag fencing, and then line 206, which is the exemption for construction materials by school districts. In contrast to the House, they have a broader exemption, but it's one time, and the Senate has a more isolated exemption, but is ongoing. So the effective dates are important to note with that provision and also the footnote. So the effects, and I should also note at this point that the legacy item changes are basically these provisions. So line 209, estimated reduction of $10.5 million, and then in FY24-25, $18.6 million. Line 220 shows the changes to the, just slightly below that. Under the estate tax, the exclusion for the spousal portability. Apologies for that, but that should be tracked one line below. The subtotal still remains the same of $1.1 million reduction in FY22-23 and a $10.4 million reduction in FY24-25. Moving down to line 235, call your attention to that proposal, which is a modification to the statewide property tax levy. So this was originally part of the Senate's property taxes subcommittee report and was the largest tax revenue change within that proposal. It shows an initial reduction in the proportional reduction to the commercial industrial property and then the seasonal residential recreation levy. But then the bulk of it is the 10-year phase-out that occurs over 10 years, approximately 10% each year, proportionally, until the full effect is realized in tax year 35, which is a full phase-out of the levy. Moving down to lawful gambling taxes, this covers the changes to the combined net receipts tax. The first bracket is increased slightly to $100,000, and the rate is reduced from 9% to 5%. This results in an estimated tax reduction beginning in FY24 of $6.8 million, and then ongoing based on the forecast of those items. And that concludes the Senate's walkthrough of the tax policy portion. So
thank
we
you.
Can move ahead now to the property tax aids and credits. What I will say here is that, as noted previously, the largest component of the property tax subcommittee report was the state general levy modification and phase out. However, I'll draw your attention to a couple of other items within this proposal briefly. Line 13 shows the modifications to the homestead market value exclusion program. This increases the market value exclusion and then provides a longer phase out period. It's estimated that 121,000 homesteads would newly qualify for the greater exclusion, and 1.25 million homesteads would receive a larger homestead market value exclusion as a result. This has an estimated effect in FY25 of decreased property tax refunds being paid by the state, so it shows an savings of approximately $7.4 million. Moving on to page 8, we'll skip all the way ahead to line 53. We show the property tax refund interactions of modifying the Class D rate. I'll also note that the effects of the rate changes are also for a two-year period, 24 and 25, and are offset with transition aid, which is effective for 2 years in pay 24 and 25, and that's detailed on line 84 of page 9. And then, so moving on to page 9 then, we see that the Senate also has the special targeting modifications, the threshold lowered from 12% to 10%, and then the maximum refund is changed to $2,000. This has an effect of increasing these types of refunds in FY24 and 25 by approximately $4 million. Finally, moving down to line 85, you see electric generation transition aid to local governments. This is for plants that qualify properties that qualify that are taken offline to offset some of the property tax effects within those communities. Transition aid is provided. So the first fiscal year where its effective is in pay 24 for FY25 cost of $5.2 million. I'll draw your attention to the footnote, which provides more context on that proposal. And then moving on to line 98, we see a riparian buffer credit allowed. It's credited at 100% rate, calculated on eligible 2A and 2B land. It's calculated based on the net tax capacity value of that land, and the Department of Revenue estimates that approximately 430,000 acres statewide would qualify for this riparian buffer credit. So then, moving all the way to page 11, we see the subtotal for the Senate's various changes, and that's on line 122, approximately $140,000 in increased state spending in the property tax aids and credits area, and then approximately $14.9 million in FY24-25. And I think I'll conclude my walkthrough there.
Mr. Wilms, thank you so much. And Ms. Templin, Michelle, thank you so much for going over those spreadsheets. Members, with that, we will start the side-by-side. Article 1. Mr. Williams. Ms. Pollack. Whoever wants to begin. And again, members, let's take questions after each article as they each will go over. So, Mr. Williams, are you starting? Or Ms. Pollack? All right.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll begin by going through, starting to go through the Article 1, the federal update article. And because members are familiar with the concept of the federal update and many of the provisions that are included in both House and Senate bills, I will just briefly describe the approach that the Senate bill is taking to the federal update and conformity in this article, and then Mr. Williams will supplement that with a few more comments about any differences in the House approach. So the federal update article updates the reference in Minnesota statutes to the Internal Revenue Code as amended through November 15th of 2021 for purposes of the tax administration chapter, the definition of the Internal Revenue Code, and the definition of net income in the income tax chapter, and the property tax refund chapter and the estate tax chapter. The current reference date in the Internal Revenue Code is the code as amended through December 31st of 2018. And there have been several legislative, significant federal legislative acts since that date. And so to address nonconformity to those federal provisions, the Senate and the House bills and the governor have proposed a one-time special limited adjustment for nonconformity for tax years 2017 to 2021, resulting from the amount calculated through the amendments to the income tax chapter as of the 2021 first special session bill, and the amount calculated under the income tax chapter incorporating changes to the code as amended through November 15th of 2021. The nonconformity adjustment is an adjustment to net income and is allowed to the extent that the taxpayer reported a nonconformity adjustment on their return in tax years beginning in 2017 and ending in 2021, and to the extent that's allowed under the article. The adjustment would be part of the 2022 return. The adjustment would exclude three provisions and would therefore allow taxpayers full retroactive conformity via amended returns. And for the Senate's bill includes the following three items. Exclusion from gross income of discharge of qualified principal residence indebtedness for tax years 2021 to 2025. Special rules for disaster-related personal casualty losses, allowing individuals have a net who have a net disaster loss related to a non-COVID federally declared disaster, generally in the months of January and February of 2020. And then finally, modification of student loan forgiveness, allowing the amount in tax years 2021 to 2025, allowing the amount of forgiven student loan indebtedness to be excluded from gross income. Mr. Chair, that's all I have for this article. Mr. Williams has further comments.
Thank you. Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt, Chair Nelson, and members, Article 1 of that House bill is similar to the Senate Article 1. However, I want to discuss a few small technical changes and then a few substantive changes. First, the House has some clarifying language about earned income, or the Senate has some clarifying language about earned income that the House does not contain in its bill. I think it's mostly a technical difference. I think it would be pretty substantively identical. Second, the House bill, the special limited adjustment is drafted as an adjustment to tax rather than an adjustment to net income. Again, I think that the effect for taxpayers would be the same between those two provisions. It's more just a drafting difference. The House includes some expiration dates on the business interest deduction that are not included in the Senate bill. Again, I think it's mostly technical. And then the House repeals some temporary conformity sections that were enacted in last year's tax bill. Again, I don't think there's a significant substantive impact to those. In terms of substantive differences, the House has full retroactivity on four provisions of federal conformity that the Senate does not. So that's they're primarily business grant provisions related to the tax treatment of those. So there's the shuttered venue operator grants, the targeted EIDL advances, restaurant revitalization grants, and then the Treasury Program Management Authority provisions. And then, as Ms. Templin mentioned, the House bill does not conform retroactively to certain provisions related to charitable contributions. So that concludes my discussion of the House conformity article, and I'm happy to answer any questions that members might have.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll move to Article 2. Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt, Senator Chair Nelson, and members, I'm going to talk about Article 2 of the House bill. So Sections 1, 2, and 3 relate to the beginning farmer credit. Section 1 of the House bill expands eligibility for that credit to include beginning farmers who have structured their businesses as LLCs. Section 2 of the House language allows sales of agricultural assets to family members. That's disallowed under current law. And Section 3 of the House language reduces the amount of credit allocations by $300,000 and then it appropriates the same amount for the Rural Finance Authority to develop an online application system. It also requires the Rural Finance Authority to promote the availability of the credit and provide application assistance to socially disadvantaged farmers and ranchers. And next section is a Senate provision.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate Section 1 also pertains to the beginning farmer tax credit and makes changes to the report that the Rural Finance Authority is required to submit to legislative committees. The report deadline is extended by a year to include data through 2022 on the number of beginning farmers by race and ethnicity and, to the extent available, the number of beginning farmers who were members of a socially disadvantaged group, as that term is defined in the Internal Revenue Code.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Markert and Chair Nelson, Section 4 of the House language increases the dollar amount threshold for the Small Business Investment Credit, which is commonly called the Angel Investment Credit. It also increases the allocation for tax year 2022 to $12 million from $5 million. Section 2 of the Senate language is the same. And then Section 5 of the House language it adjusts the film credit that was enacted in last year's omnibus tax bill. It allows production costs for the credit to be span over a consecutive 12-month period rather than just one calendar year. And Section 3 is Senate language.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Section 3 is the new markets tax credit, which allows credits for qualifying investments in qualified low-income community business entities. The credit would be $50 million for greater Minnesota businesses and $50 million for metro area businesses. And taking us through page 9 of the side-by-side.
We don't have a page number on there, so you will have to, Ms.
Pollack,
give us the, if you know that. You have, yeah. This,
I believe
so. House members, anyway, on this side, we may not have a number, so you might just have, tell us what's on the top of the page, if you
Sure, Chair Markort and Chair Nelson. Section 6 of the House language, which is the same in the Senate language, it allows a pass-through entity to allocate 100% of a resident partner's income for purposes of calculating the PTE tax, and it also allows tiered pass-through entities to elect and pay the tax.
Mr. Chair, Section 5 of the Senate bill is one of a few provisions that pertains to the estate tax modifications that would allow for portability of the deceased spouse unused exclusion amount. In addition, the section strikes obsolete language regarding the phased-in estate tax exclusion for the years that the exclusion was phased in.
Mr. Williams.
In Section 7 of the House language, requires a pass-through entity that filed a PTE tax return to file an amended return if they had a federal partnership level audit, and that's the same in the Senate language. Section 8 of the House language is an addition for amounts deducted through a dependent flexible spending account. This relates to the House expansion of the dependent care credit later in the bill. It essentially prevents double dipping, so amounts used to claim the dependent care credit they would have to add them back if they were deducted at the federal level.
Next page, then, looks like. Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Section 7 in the House article is an increase in the amount of the K-12 subtraction, essentially doubling the subtraction for each category, so to $3,250 for each qualifying child in grades 1 to 6, and then to $5,000 for each qualifying child in grades 7 to 12. And those amounts would be adjusted annually for inflation.
Mr. Williams.
So Section 9 of the House language expands the military retirement subtraction. It essentially allows an individual who has a portion of their pension income through a federal civilian pension to claim the subtraction for the amount of their federal civilian pension that was earned through military service. And then Section 10 of the House bill is the Social Security subtraction. So the House language allows a 100% Social Security subtraction for taxpayers with AGI up to $75,000 for married couples filing joint returns and $58,600 for other taxpayers. The bill also includes a hold harmless, so taxpayers could also elect to claim the alternate subtraction allowed under current law.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, the Senate provision is Section 8 of the article, and it would allow a full subtraction of taxable Social Security benefits. Section 9 of the Senate article provides a subtraction for pension income received by public safety officers and firefighters that are members of a state plan. It would also apply to taxpayers who were part of a similar or analogous federal public safety pension plan. And the subtraction would apply if the individual has not reached age 55 before December 31st of this year and has attained at least 20 years of service as a member of that of the plan.
Mr. Williams.
And Section 11 of the House language relates to the emergency assistant for post-secondary student grants. These are grants that are offered by the Office of Higher Education to students attending Minnesota colleges and universities that have a demonstrable homeless population. They're emergency financial assistance and under current law they're taxed, so the House bill would allow a subtraction for emergency grants provided under that section. Section 12 of the House bill relates to a provision in the omnibus HHS bill in the House. It's a workforce incentive grant program. It's essentially a grant program to provide grants to staff for behavioral health, housing, disability, and home and community-based service providers. So the House bill contains language allowing a subtraction for those grants.
Mr. Chair, Section 10 of the Senate article would exempt nuclear decommissioning reserve funds from Minnesota income tax. Section 11 of the Senate article reduces the first-tier income tax rate from 5.35% to 2.8%, and it also provides a technical update for the four tax brackets for inflation as provided under current law. And similarly, in Section 12, this simply updates the statutory year for the inflation adjustment requirement under current law.
Mr. Williams.
Section 13 of the House language allows a sole member of a single-member LLC to claim the credit for taxes paid to another state when the LLC paid tax in another state on net income. Section 14 of the House language is the Great Start Child Care and Dependent Care Credit. This makes some significant changes to the state dependent care credit. First, under current law, the state dependent care credit is tied to the federal dependent care credit, so the House language would decouple from the federal credit and instead establish a separate state formula for the credit. Under current law, the credit rate ranges from 35 to 20%, and under the House language, the credit rate is set to 50% and then phased down, beginning at $125,000 of adjusted gross income. It's a two-tier phase-out, starting at $125,000 of adjusted gross income and then phasing down to 20%, and then again phasing down all the way to 0% above a $400,000 of adjusted gross income. Lastly, there's an increase in the dependent care credit for what the bill deems young children ages 0 to 4. And the parents with young children would be allowed to claim an additional $3,000 of expenses for the purposes of the credit. If they have one young child, $6,000 of expenses for two young children, and $9,000 of expenses for three or more young children.
Mr. Chair, Section 13 of the Senate article increases the income level at which the dependent care credit under current law begins to phase out from $52,230 to $70,000.
Mr. Williams.
Section 15 of the House language allows taxpayers who file their individual income tax returns using an individual taxpayer identification number rather than a Social Security number to claim the Minnesota Working Family Credit. Section 16 of the bill relates to the Minnesota Education Credit. So the House language changes the income measure used for the credit to adjusted gross income from household income. It increases the phase-out threshold to $70,000 of adjusted gross income, and then it requires the phase-out threshold to be annually adjusted for inflation.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, similarly, Section 14 also changes the income measure and it increases the phase-out threshold to $50,000, also requiring the commissioner to adjust the threshold for inflation. And there's also a technical provision that's taken from a repealed section of law that's contained later in the bill that is to add language for fiscal year filers to be included in the income measure for this provision. Section 15 increases the second tier of the R&D credit from 4% to 4.25%.
Okay, I'm going to take a little break. Oh, well, no. So what we're going to do, I see Mr. Clayman, and Mr. Clayman has to leave at 7 o'clock because he has the might be a more interesting conference committee on liquor. And so what he's got, some of Article 2, some of Article 3, and some of Article 7. So I'm going to have him, if that's all right, members, go through those provisions, and then he can head off to another conference committee. So, Mr. Clayman, tell us where you're. Are you starting right where we're at?
That's correct, Mr. Okay. Chair. And thank you for accommodating my schedule this evening. Starting on Section 17 in Article 2, it would actually be Section 17 through 19 on the House side relate to the historic structure credit. And those provisions allow the credit to be provided in one lump sum as opposed to current law, which requires it to be taken over the course of 5 years. Those provisions are retroactive to applications for allocation certificates issued in 2018 and later, provided that those developers have not yet been issued a credit certificate.
Mr. Chair, Section 16 of the Senate article allows a recipient of the Historic Structure Rehabilitation Credit to assign the credit in whole to an assignee.
So, Mr. Clayman, are you going to be able to get through all your parts in 15 minutes? I mean, that's what we want you to just do right now. We'll give you 15 minutes to just finish your parts off. So just...
Sure, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I can. If it's okay with you and members, I can just go through the House side, and then Ms. Pollack can go through the Senate side after I'm done with everything.
Okay. Yeah, that'd be. Senator Rest.
Someone to answer questions that we have of the parts that he is going through later. Then
we will be able to provide that. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Senator Rest. Mr. Clayman, if you would proceed with your provisions.
Sure. Then Section 20, Article 2, that allows the, or Section 20 of Article 2, that moves the historic, or that moves the sunset date for the historic structure credit out 8 years to 2030. Also, Section 26 on the House side is an administrative provision related to how the retroactivity piece would work. Section 21, Article 2, makes the Minnesota Student Loan Credit refundable for tax years 2022 and later. Section 22 provides a temporary increase to the maximum student loan credit to $1,400 temporarily from tax years 2022 through 2028. Section 23 and 24 relate to the credit for stillbirths. These provisions provide changes related to the documentation requirements required specifically for stillbirths that occur out of state, and also for eligible individuals in situations that occur in-state versus out-of-state, and for individuals who gave birth to the stillbirth but who are not listed as a parent on the birth certificate. And then jumping forward to Section 25, Article 2. This is the income definition for property tax refunds. This excludes the workforce incentive grants from the income definition used by the property tax refund program. That's effective for rent paid in 2022. Skipping ahead to Section 26, that's the historic structure credit administrative provision referenced earlier. Section 27 provides a temporary individual income tax subtraction for unemployment insurance benefits, that's retroactive to tax year 2021, and you could, individuals could subtract amounts up to $10,200, and that phases out as well. Section 28 provides for income tax rebates for parents of qualifying children, the children ages 16 years and under. This would be retroactive to tax year 2021, and the rebates could go up to $325 per qualifying child. Those would also be auto-adjusted by the Department of Revenue, and there would be a simplified process that would also be in place for those individuals who do not have an income tax liability and are not filing an individual income tax return. And then finally, Mr. Chair, in Article 2, Section 29, the House provides a repealer related to the Minnesota Education Credit due to the transition from household income to adjusted gross income. And, Mr. Chair, that would conclude the House side of Article 2.
Okay. Mr. Clayman, if you'd go into Article 3, then.
Sure.
Provisions there on the House side.
Mr. Chair, members, Article 3 is the sales tax article for the House. Sections 1 and 7 relate to the county fair sales tax exemption. Article 1 just allows a county fair to spend its sales tax savings from the exemption on improving its facilities at the county fairgrounds, regardless of the ownership of the fairgrounds. And Section 7 allows pre-sales to qualify for the exemption to the county fairs. Sections 2 and 16 are related to the National Sports Center, the sales tax collected from the National Sports Center in Blaine. And what those two sections do is they dedicate the portion of the sales tax that's collected from the National Sports Center in Blaine and dedicate it to the amateur sports account for the promotion of amateur sports. Sections 3 and 16 on the House side relate to the sales tax exemption for farm fencing. And those would include fencing material in the definition of farm machinery, which would allow that material to qualify for the exemption. And in addition, Section 16 provides an additional exemption for materials used to build and maintain a farm fence. Section 4, Article 3, applies the occasional sales tax exemption to transfers of property between the single member of an LLC and the LLC. Sections 5 and 18 provide for a retroactive sales tax exemption for fiber and conduit material purchased by an ISP or broadband provider for the provision of retail internet services. Section 6 provides a capital equipment exemption for restaurants. For equipment used in the production of prepared food and beverages. Section 7 is the other part of the county fair sales tax exemption discussed previously. Section 8 extends the expiration date for the sales tax exemption for rebuilding in the town of Mazeppa due to the fire in 2018. Section 9 provides exemptions for various public facilities for owned by local governments for the Tasca County courthouses, for Maple Grove, and for the city of Wayzata. Section 10 is related to the farm fencing material exemption. Section 11 is the general construction sales tax exemption. This is based on the construction material exemption that was in the governor's bill. The difference between the governor's bill and the House provision is that the House provision, the exemption is for 18 months, retroactive to sales after June 30, 2021 until January 1 of 2023, and the refunds would have to be paid by July 1, 2023 as well. And that, in the House bill, that's Section 11, 13, 14, and 15. And those are the collection, application, and refund provisions that are related to the construction exemptions. Section 12 is a construction materials exemption for the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport for various projects. Again, those are also limited to 18 months. Section 13, again, is the related to the 13 and 14 are related, and 15 are related to the general construction sales tax exemption for local governments and nonprofits. Section 16 is the National Sports Center exemption. Article 3, Section 17 moves the effective date for the exemption for Minnesota State High School League's tickets from 2027 to 2030. Section 18, again, is related to the fiber and conduit exemption. That's the retroactive refund piece. Section 19, that's again related to Section 11. It does something different. The Section 19 provides a special exemption provision, which states that the individual construction exemptions provided in Sections 20 through 27 of the bill, that 18-month exemption window does not apply to those exemptions that are listed for schools in Sections 20 through 27. And then moving on to Section 20 is one of those individual school exemptions for Chisholm Public Schools.
So, Mr. Clayman, I think folks can kind of, the rest are just, if you notice, the projects are listed. I think you can see those, if that's all right, members. We can. So the last article then for Mr. Clayman is Article 7, the very popular local option sales tax, Madam Chair. So if you, I think, just kind of maybe go over the city, and I don't know if you have the percent of the sales tax increase. I don't see it here, but I don't know if you have that or not with your, but maybe just the increase, and maybe if you have the amount, and we can look at the rest later, and kind of the city or the county, the entity, and then whatever the increase is, a half percent or whatever that is, and just a little bit, and then quick summary.
Sure. Yep, Mr. Cherry, I'll do a brief summary. Sections 1 through 3 amend the general local sales tax law. Some clarifying changes in Section 1. Section 2 provides some changes regarding the requirements for resolutions for modifications, the requirement to submit an amended resolution if the project changes after the submission to the legislature has been done, and also establishes new requirements to show nexus in that legislative submission. And there are four in the bill. There are four nexus considerations, nexus between the non-resident taxpayers and the users of the project. And that's sections 1 through 3. Sections 4 through 7 relate to the Rochester local option sales tax. That is a, that's right. And Mr. Chair, I don't have the, in front of me, the percentage increase, but I believe that one is a 0.5% sales.
It's not an increase, it's just an extension.
Or it's an extension of an existing tax, exactly. For street reconstruction, flood control, and a recreation complex, there's also an additional amount for any one of those projects that can be, that the local sales tax funds can be used for that. Section A is a Cook County lodging tax provision that strikes their authority to impose an admissions tax and then extends the expiration of the tax from 15 to 30 years. Section 9 is the City of Marshall local sales tax. That's a 0.5% tax, $16 million for construction of an aquatic center. Section 10 is removes the expiration date for the Plymouth local lodging tax that was authorized in 2019. Section 11 is the modification of the existing City of Edina local sales tax that allows the project cost for its Bramer Park project to go up from $21.6 million to $46.9 million. And the duration of the tax would be reduced from 19 to 17 years under the proposal. Section 12 is City of Grand Rapids proposal to modify their 0.5% sales tax by increasing the duration from 7 to 10 years and increasing the project cost from $5.98 million to $10.6 million. Section 13 is the City of Aikens local sales tax. That's a 1% tax to fund two projects, a municipal building, parks and trails, in the total amount of $9.3 million. Section 14 is the City of Black Ducks 0.5% sales tax that could be used for four projects, a campground, a walking trail, a wayside rest, or excuse me, five projects, a golf course, and reconstruction of a library. That's a duration of 20 years. Section 15 is a tax, proposed tax for the City of Bloomington. It's a 0.5% tax for three projects, $32 million. For an ice garden, $70 million for the Health and Wellness Center, and $33 million for the Center for the Arts. Section 16 is City of Brooklyn Center's local sales tax proposal of 0.5%, a $55 million project for the Brooklyn Center Community Center. Section 17 is the City of East Grand Forks. That's a 1.25% proposed tax for two projects, $16.5 million for a civic center, and $5 million for VFW and Blue Line Arena. Section 18 is the City of Golden Valley's local sales tax proposal. There's an error in the side-by-side The tax on the side-by-side says 0.5%. It's actually proposed to be 0.75%. And that's for two projects, one at $38 million and one at $35 million. Section 19, City of Henderson's 0.5% local sales tax to fund a $240,000 campground project. Section 20 is the City of Proctor's proposed 0.5% local sales tax for a $3.85 million project to fund a new regional trail spur in the city. Section 21 is a proposal by the Rice County to impose a 0.375% local sales tax to fund a $77 million correctional facility. Section 22 is the City of Roseville's 0.5% local sales tax proposal to fund three projects, $42 million for a maintenance facility, $7 million for a new license and passport center, and $16 million for a new pedestrian bridge. Section 23 is a Winona County proposed local sales tax of 0.25% to fund $28 million for a new correctional facility. Section 24 is a City of Woodbury provision that allows the City of Woodbury to dedicate two-thirds of a local lodging tax that it collects for a local lodging tax to provide for capital improvements to public recreational facilities. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes the House side of Article 7.
Mr. Klayman, perfect timing. We will send you off to your next conference committee, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Appreciate Mr. Chair, that. Members.
And before we move to Ms. Pollack, I've been meaning we missed one staff member in all the introductions, and he's on Zoom, Sean Hadorn, who is the DFL House researcher, so I want to recognize him. So, Ms. Pollack, where did we leave off in Article 2?
Mr. Chair, I think we left off right after the historic rehabilitation credit. And so that would have been Section 16 of the Senate bill.
All right. So Article Section 16.
Article 1, Section, or sorry, Article 2, Section 16.
Article 2, Section 16 of the Senate bill. So, members, thank you for your cooperation allowing Mr. Klayman to give his provisions. So. All right, Ms. Pauley.
Mr. Chair, so right after Section 16 of Article 2 on the Senate side indicates Section 25, which is the repealer in the Senate bill, it's listed next to the House article Section 20 here because it also applies to the sunset date of the credit, but it repeals the date. And so that the repealer comes in Section 25, that it's comparable to the House sunset date in Section 20. Moving on to Section 17 is the small business credits for paid family leave benefits, which provides a credit to employers of 50 or fewer employees who provide either direct payments of paid family leave benefits or pay insurance premiums for paid family leave benefits. The credit is 100% of the direct payments paid up to $3,000 per employee, or 50% of the amount of insurance premiums paid up to $3,000 per employee. Section 18 provides a reference to the new markets tax credit in the income tax chapter as it's calculated under an earlier section in the bill. Section 19 provides a reference to the public safety office or pension subtraction for purposes of calculating AMT. Sections 20, 21, and 22 all pertain to the modifications to allow the portability of the deceased spouse's unused exclusion amount and also striking obsolete language. Section 23 provides a reference to the new markets tax credit in the insurance premiums chapter. Section 24 provides for a temporary preceptor credit, allowing a refundable credit for preceptors who are advanced practice registered nurses, physician's assistants, or mental health professionals who serve as a health professions student preceptor. The credit is $2,500, $3,750, or $5,000, depending on the number of hours that the individual served as a preceptor. This section also requires a report on various aspects of the credit, credit claimants, and so forth. Mr. Chair, moving on to Section 5 of the Senate bill. Section 25, as I mentioned, includes a repeal of the sunset date for the historic structure rehabilitation credit. This section also repeals the add back for Section 2529 college saving plan distributions that are used for elementary and secondary school tuition. The effect of this repealer would be to conform to the provision from the TCJA, which allowed 529 distributions to be used for these purposes. The section also repeals the definition of household income used for the K-12 credit. This definition is no longer necessary since an earlier section switches the income measure to FAGI. Mr. Chair, I think that concludes the income article.
All right. Ms. Pollack, thank you so much. And Mr. Williams and Mr. Klayman for doing Article 2. Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Just one Chair. Question. Ms. Pollack, could you repeat the last statement about the just repeat the last bullet point, if you would, please.
Ms. Pollack, on Section 25, just kind of the last bullet point you had on that.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Chair Nelson, Section 25 repeals three provisions. First, it repeals the definition of household income for the K-12 credit because the credit definition of income is changed to FAGI in an earlier section of the bill. This separate definition of income is no longer needed. The repealer also repeals the add-back for Section 529 college savings plan distributions that are used for elementary and secondary school tuition, which would have the effect of conforming to the TCJA allowance of 529 plans for this purpose. And then finally, it repeals the sunset of the historic structure rehabilitation credit.
Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have just a couple of questions on House Section 1 dealing with the beginning farmer credit. I wonder who the House author of those provisions, and I'm assuming that Sections 1 and 2 were authored by the same person in a single bill.
Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt, Senator Rust. I believe Representative Miller carried Section 1 related to the farmers with limited liability companies. And I think
Section 1 was
Representative Miller.
Was Representative Miller, okay. And Section 2?
And Sections 2 and 3, I think they were included in the House Omnibus Bill and last session as yeah. well. And Ms. Templin, I think can help you on those two, maybe.
I authored that bill last year. Yes.
Is that yours?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, then Section 5 in the House bill, what is the cost of that? Is it negligible or what is it?
So, Senator Rest, that's on the film credit?
That's correct.
Yeah, I don't believe there's any cost because
no
it's
cost.
Basically just moving from a calendar year to a consecutive 12-month period, which allows it to be more workable. So there's no additional cost.
Thank you. And then on Section 6, the pass-through entity tax, I'm trying to recall, was this a provision that the department objected to?
Senator Rest, I can tell you that was a provision, of course, put into last year's bill, and this now is trying to do some clarification. My understanding is there were kind of five outstanding kind of issues with this. Four of the five, I believe, have all been settled, so there's kind of one more issue yet that...
Is this the issue that's still hanging out there?
I don't know for sure, Senator Rest. I don't know if staff could... Ms. Pollack?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I would probably ask Ms. Bayer, the commissioner, to confirm, but I think within this language, there are the five issues within this section, and one is yet to be resolved.
So there is still discussion. I mean, I see that the language is the same in both, but it's not totally resolved. at this point? Just yes or no?
Yeah.
Great, thank you.
Senator Rest.
And then in Section 8 for the House, was that in the governor's proposal as well as the House? Section 8, dependent flexible spending accounts?
Senator Rest, I don't believe that would be, but Mr. Williams, you want to?
Chair Markwart and Senator Rest know that that section was not in the governor's bill.
Okay, so that's a House provision. Thank you.
Mr. Williams,
and
that's a House position.
Chair Markwart and Senator Rest, that's correct. It's a House position only.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. And Section 12, how usual or unusual is it to make an appropriation in the tax bill for an HHS provision, and who carries it on their spreadsheet, HHS or the tax committee? This one.
Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, the income tax subtraction for that provision, there is a zero cost carried on the spreadsheet. The grants for that provision are being carried in the HHS House Committee. And the reason why there's no cost on the spreadsheet is because because it hasn't been included, the grants haven't been incorporated into the MMB economic forecast.
So, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Rest.
So the reason why Section 12 is there is because it's part of the description of the workforce incentive program that's in the House bill. It just looks funny to see grant payments and then there's no cost to it.
I see. Yeah.
The title was a little bit.
Chair Markwart and Senator Rest, so the grant program is carried in the House Omnibus HHS bill, and I may have misspoken or been less than clear when I was with this on the walkthrough. So the provision in the House bill is only the income tax subtraction related to a separate grant program carried in another bill.
Senator Rest.
Okay. Section 14, the head note there says great start child care. Is that just a term of art?
Senator Rest, that
asking.
Yes, that is. It was kind of through our the folks working on our child care. It's a great start.
It should have been named particular to
the House bill. Yes,
it should have been in quotation marks because it's a special program.
Yes,
that's correct.
Yes,
thank you. Let's see. I believe that's all my questions for this section. That's all my questions for. Section 27, what is the cost of that?
Section 27.
That's the unemployment. That is $10,200.
The unemployment, that is, I believe, $160.1 million one time. We can look at it. Ms. Templin.
Mr. Chair,
thank you. That is the unemployment insurance subtraction is $160.9 million.
$160.9 million. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Chair Nelson.
I think you have two questions. One, I'll just start with the one that we were just on. And that is the unemployment insurance subtraction for up to $10,200. My question is, I believe the feds do tax this. We did not tax the pandemic unemployment insurance benefits last year,
right,
because the feds. But I do believe that this is normally taxable on the federal income. Can I just get some confirmation on that?
Yeah. Mr. William.
Chair Markwart and Senator Nelson. Yes, typically unemployment compensation is treated as taxable income like any other kind of income. And as you mentioned, last year, the federal government enacted a one-time exclusion from gross income for $10,200 of unemployment compensation. So that was effective for tax year 2021. in the House bill, or excuse me, for tax year 2020, and then the House bill would enact a somewhat similar provision for tax year 2021.
Thank you,
Chair Nelson.
And then just one other question, and this was maybe for the commissioner or Ms. Bears. It's back on page 9, which is section 6, and it has to do with the pass-through entity tax.
Okay.
And we've had a little discussion about that, that most of the issues have been resolved. However, there's still one outstanding one. And because we're on such a short time schedule, I think we need to speak to that outstanding issue tonight and get a better understanding of what that is. And so I'm wondering if the commissioner, you may have mentioned it in your comments, but I think it's important to know what outstanding issue is causing some concern.
Very good. Commissioner Doty, welcome back. So we're batting 800. 4 out of 5, which is, you know, pretty good. But where did we pop out or strike out? Where are we still questioning in the strike zone, so to speak?
So Chair Marquardt, Chair Nelson, I'm going to ask Margaret Reisdorf to come up, who's behind me. And this is her area here. So.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself, please? And
Sure. Good evening. My name is Margaret Reisdorf, and I'm an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd love to try to address this question. And so the change that you're referring to, Senator Nelson and members, deals with the allocation rules for partnerships. So as you know, the pass-through entity tax was enacted pursuant to federal guidance last year as a way to avoid the SALT cap for owners of pass-through entities. And the way the SALT cap is avoided is that the entity pays the tax as opposed to the individuals, because the individuals are subject to the SALT cap, entities are not. And so typically, in last year, we enacted an allocation rule that functions as you would see in an entity tax. Typically, business entities only pay tax in states where they conduct business, and that's generally called source jurisdiction. And so you don't tend to have a lot of conflict between states, and you don't have as much conflict with states taxing the same income, because the income can only be effectively connected to one state or another. So what's concerning about this change in allocation rule for just partnerships, not S corporations, is that it would allow allocation to happen on the basis of residence of owners, not on the entity's activity. And so while we're just concerned that this would create conflict among states looking to tax the same income more than once, one on the basis of residence, one on the basis of source. And that would have credit for taxes paid implications, et cetera. So I hope I'd be happy to answer any questions, but that's essentially it, is that it allocating based on residence is typically what we do for individuals, not entities, and it could create issues for the same income being taxed by more than one state for different reasons, some on the basis of residency, some on the basis of source, because when you conduct business in a state, you have to pay estimated taxes to that jurisdiction.
Chair Nelson.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, yeah. So just a follow-up to that, I vaguely remember this discussion when we had this in committee. Yeah. And I certainly appreciate the clarity. I mean, that's one of the key things about good tax policy is it's clarity. But I also understand the issue about why that should be allocated as such. And my question is, would not a special letter ruling help clear up any concerns that the department might have?
Madam Chair, we are not going into special letter ruling tonight. We've got work to do before midnight yet. So.
I'm not going in there. I just want to know if it could help clarify.
Ms. Reisdorf, if you care to answer that, you may.
Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson, no, unfortunately, because if a neighboring state has jurisdiction to tax income in that state, they have the right to do that. And so what that
potentially leaves Minnesota is having to defend for our residents. You know, typically, it's the state of residence that would then give credit for taxes paid to that other jurisdiction. We'd have to come to some kind of agreement over whether or not that credit was due.
Thank you. I would,
Chair Nelson.
We'll save time for later, but I would say this has not been an issue in the other 16 states that have done this, and so I'm hopeful that we can figure out a way to proceed, even if it's not a special letter ruling, whatever might help us join those other 16 states. So we'll deal with that later. Thank you.
Thank you, and there are folks that are trying to kind of work on the sound, so there's technicians right now doing that. Representative Davis.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. To kind of follow up with Chair Nelson, I think your comments and questions are very, very appropriate because 16 other states do this and have absolutely no problem with it. Why does Minnesota have a problem with it? What's our problem?
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, it's, you know, I think you're right. I think this is new, this tax. It's been enacted in some of the early adopter states, speaking of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland, and those states had argued that they were not necessarily following the federal guidance. They were arguing that the SALT cap was unconstitutional. We know now as of April 18th that the SALT cap is constitutional. I don't know. We just know that when you've got the same income being taxed on the basis of residency and at the same time basis of source, that the potential for looking for credit for taxes paid for that state that of residence from that state of residence happens. And in order for an income tax to be constitutional and fairly apportioned, a state would need to seriously consider giving credit. So,
Representative Davids,
so I don't know the answer to your question, except that it's new and that I think we have a right to be concerned about it. It would help to know what the reason for it, I guess. But
well, Mr. Chairman, to the witness, I think we're concerned about something that in past history has not shown up at all. So why don't we take this thing out for a spin and see if it works? I think it's very important that we do this. And how in the world Minnesota can be the only state that has problems in the world on this issue is beyond me. So let's get this figured out quick. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So,
yeah, and I don't thank you. I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that we did do this last year. And from some of the estimates I'm seeing, businesses might be seeing tax cuts of $150 to $200 million statewide. Some of that now. The Bar of Revenue doesn't have a full year, but some of the kind of other indications, and when you've seen some of these forecasts come out, you're seeing this increase in income taxes over expectations, and part of it is the timing of these pass-through entities paying early to take advantage of the SALT thing that we passed. So, granted, we might be trying to figure something out, but let's not say this isn't working, because, in fact, businesses are seeing some very, very big tax cuts from what the state of Minnesota did last year. Yep. And you were the author of that bill, Representative Davids. But so, I mean, let's not get this out of perspective. We'll try to continue to work through and see if we can get this area done. But this has been a huge success for the state of Minnesota up to this point, and we just can't lose sight of that.
Thank you.
Chair Nelson.
And so, Mr. Chair, it has been a huge, huge success. That was a great bipartisan work that we did last year. But and my comments are not at all to indicate that it's not a success. My comments, and I won't speak for Representative Davids, but my comments were, why can't we do what the other 16 states are doing? And I just have not yet heard a reason why not. And that's what I'm looking for. Either let's get on board and take advantage of this, or if there's a problem, we need to identify what it is, but why it is that Minnesota is so unique. 16 other states are doing this. Why can't we? And I was very serious when I said a special letter ruling. I thought that would perhaps, provide the clarity in an uncertain area. But we won't go into that tonight. But I'm just saying we need to really drill down and see what is the issue with Minnesota. Like, why can't we do this and make what is successful even more successful?
Very good. So let's see if we can continue to work on this in the next couple days and see if there's some resolve. That would be great if we could do that. So thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, Representative Davids for those comments. Thank you, Ms. Reisdorf. Anything else on Article 2?
Those were my questions.
All right. Let's move on to Article 3. Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair, Senate Article 3 is the sales and use tax article. Section 4 that appears first on the side-by-side for the sales tax articles pertain to adding fencing on agricultural property to the sales tax exemption for agricultural purposes and products. This is akin to the House Section 3. And Senate Section 6 provides another corollary to that section, which would provide an exemption for repair and reconstruction materials used on farm fencing. Sections 1 and 2 of the Senate article provide that the sale of taxable food and beverages for consumption in a private suite or private skybox or private box seat or at a preferred seating location at a collegiate event do not invalidate the sales tax exemption under existing law for the sale of license to use the private suite, skybox, box seat, or preferred seating right. Section 3 provides that amenities that are included in the privilege of admission are exempt if they're purchased by the taxpayer who sells the privilege of admission. Section 5 provides a sales tax exemption for animal shelters. An animal shelter is a nonprofit organization in the business of rescuing, sheltering, or finding homes for unwanted animals. There are typical exclusions from the exemption that are also seen in our sales tax exemptions for certain nonprofit entities. The section would also provide an exemption for the sale or adoption of animals and the sale of associated animal supplies and equipment by a nonprofit animal shelter. And then finally, it would exempt sales from sales made by and events run by an animal shelter for fundraising purposes, including the sale of prepared food, candy, soft drinks at a fundraising event, subject to a few limits listed there on the summary. Section 6 provides a sales tax exemption for construction materials used for the North Metro Regional Public Safety Training Facility, which is the same as one provision in House Section 9. Section 7 provides an exemption for construction materials purchases by contractors that are used in a contract for buildings and facilities used principally by school districts and for materials purchased for infrastructure projects when purchased by a contractor as part of a contract with school districts. This exemption would be effective for sales and purchases made after June 30th of 2024. Sections 8, 9, and 10 are cross-referential sections that refer to the refund process and refund application process for that school district sales tax exemption. And then finally, Mr. Chair, Section 7 provides an exemption for certain natural gas fees that were used as a primary, I'm sorry, for sales of natural gas that were used as a primary source of residential heating during the period of February 13th to February 17th of 2021. These are payments that may be spread out over a period of many months and could appear on sales tax, on billing statements in the non-exempt months of May through October. And so this would provide a sales tax exemption for fees that appear on billing statements during those months. Mr. Chair, that concludes Senate Article 3.
Ms. Pollack, thank you so much. Representative Davids.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the department, going back to the suite licenses, I see that the Senate Section 1, Section 2, Section 3 of Section 3. You have language there for suite licenses, season ticket purchasing rights, and so forth. I thought we had cleared this up some years ago through a language that I had put in a tax bill. But it seems the department keeps changing their position on these issues. So my question to the department, if someone from the department could come forward, does the Senate language take care of what's needed here, and are we going to keep quit shifting positions on these issues?
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joanna Bears. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, we are working with the sports teams right now to help clarify this language to make sure whatever language is included, if language is included, that it's administrable and it resolves the issues that they brought forward in the first and second section of that bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Bears. How close are we to having this resolved? This needs to get resolved.
Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, we're close. We're swapping some language back and forth, so it's okay. It's close.
Well, let's get on with it and get it done. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oh, those were my comments, too. The clock is ticking. We need to get this resolved. And then just one further question, not to mix issues here, but it seems that the department is looking at the amenities included with privilege of admission, if I'm not mistaken, believing those should be taxed via cash, even though the events occurred throughout the year. And if I'm not mistaken, many believe those should be paid on the accrual method, as they all are. Or just vice versa.
It's just the opposite.
Just the opposite. My question is, though, it seems that there's a little inconsistency, though, in how the natural gas fees are. Those costs were incurred in the wintertime. Now, the PUC has said those costs need to be spread out over 63 months, which includes non-winter time. It includes the summer as well. And the department is saying there needs to be a tax on those payments that have been spread out over the summer for an event that occurred in the winter time when there is no tax. But it seems a little inconsistent with how the department is looking at the amenities included with privilege of admission. But I guess my question is, to the sales and use tax exemption with those those natural gas fees, why is it that they are taxed when the event occurred during the polar vortex when there was no tax on those utility payments?
Ms. Bears.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm going to ask one of our sales tax attorneys to come up and explain that for you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you would please introduce yourself.
I'm Dexter Wilson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. On this issue of the natural gas fee, the sale for natural gas has already occurred during that polar vortex. This is now a fee. It's a separate event that would be that would be included in the sales price of these transactions going forwards. It's different than these sales for the privilege of admission, where we know that taxable event occurs when the privilege of admission itself is sold.
Could you clarify that again, please?
For the natural gas, that there was a sale during that gas during the polar vortex, gas prices increased, but that gas was sold for a certain sales price, and that transaction has occurred, and it's done. Now we're looking at a fee, and that fee may be to recover the costs of the natural gas spike, but that fee is not for that actual natural gas. That sale has already occurred. This is a fee to continue the service, and as such, it's included in the sales price for natural gas moving forwards. So it's included in those transactions during the billing period for which this fee is imposed. In comparison, for these sales of privilege of admission, we know when that sale occurs, and it's when that privilege of admission is given, that privilege to attend a later event for the exchange of some consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Yep.
I have to say, it seems incredibly inconsistent, and I will leave it at that for now, but it seems incredibly an inconsistent interpretation, and one has to wonder if the PUC believes that these are fees, but the fees were to pay for the gas that was used during the winter time when we don't have tax on those. So I just find it rather inconsistent, and I'm afraid that description didn't quite satisfy my thinking that this is an inconsistent interpretation.
Senator Rest.
Thank you. I have a question on just to make sure that I understand between the House Section 9 and Senate Section 6. The House has all three projects. Is that correct? Itasca County.
Thank you, Mr.
Maple
Wilson.
Grove and Wayzata. But the Senate only has the one, just the Maple Grove public safety thing. Am I understanding what the difference is there now?
Mr. Chair, Pollack. Senator Rest, yes, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Anything else on Article 3? If not, we're going to move to property taxes. Article 4. And as you can see, members were going to go past a 7:30 time that had been established early.
Well, Mr. Chair, we just have 2 days to get this.
I know it. We'll keep
7:30 somewhere.
Well, it is. And however, the good news is we don't have any limitations according to television that we can go all night, I guess. So, with that, Mr. Sylvia and Mr. Swanson, welcome. Who wants to go first, Mr. Swanson? Very good.
Mr. Chair and members, Jared Swanson with House Research. I'm going to start the property tax article, which is Article 4 in the House bill. The Senate bill also has the property tax article in Article 4. So beginning in the House bill sections 1 and 3 allow joint powers school districts to allocate long-term facilities maintenance costs back to their member districts and include facility lease expenses in their member districts' lease levy authority. Section 2 of Article 4 in the House bill sets the first-year local optional revenue equalization factor to 170% of the statewide average tax base per pupil. Section 4 of the House bill provides for 8 years of 50% reduction in net tax capacity for certain property at airports that are owned or operated by a city with a population between 50,000 and 150,000.
Mr. Chair, members,
Senate
Article 4, Section 1 has the same proposal to exempt the property used by a private entity for profit, but the Senate proposes a 12-year 50% reduction, whereas, as Mr. Swanson indicated, the House revised for an 8-year reduction.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 5 of Article 4 in the House bill requires real property to be classified as commercial if the property contains more than one solar energy generating system that cannot be combined with another system for the purposes of the solar energy production tax. Section 6 extends for 8 years a property tax exemption for property in Minneapolis owned by the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe. This section would also exempt the property from having to file regular statements of exemption.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sylvia.
And members, Senate Article 4, Section 2 also extends the property tax exemption for this particular property, but the Senate proposes a 10-year extension rather than an 8-year extension as provided in the House bill.
Mr. Swanson.
Section 7 of the House bill establishes an 8-year property tax exemption for an elderly living facility in Duluth. And Section 8 provides a property tax exemption for energy storage systems The House bill would also require land on which these systems are located to remain taxable and to be classified as commercial.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Article 4, Section 3 also provides a similar new authorization property tax exemption for energy storage systems. The two differences with the Senate version is it's effective for assessment year 2023, and also instead of providing the land upon which the system is located is taxed as 3A commercial, the Senate provides that the land would be taxed according to its use.
Mr. Swanson.
Section 9 of the House bill is related to the previous section with the energy storage systems, and this would just require the owners of these properties to file an exemption application with the Department of Revenue rather than with the county.
Mr. Chair, Mr. members, the Senate has that exact same provision related to the energy storage system exemption.
Mr. Swanson.
Section 10 in the House bill provides an exemption for solar from the solar energy production tax for certain community solar gardens. So this is just attempting to clarify which solar community solar gardens are exempt from the solar energy production tax.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Article 4, Section 5 is a conforming change that adds an affordable housing market exclusion that I'll discuss in great detail in Section 9 to the statutory list of market value exclusions that would apply to any given property.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 11 of Article 4 in the House bill is a conforming change related to a community land trust provision that appears in Section 21 of the House bill. I'll discuss that more in a few minutes, but this particular provision would just state that community land trust units that are owned and used as a homestead by the occupant can qualify for the 4D classification along with the changes that occur in Section 21.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Article 4, Section 6 relates to the first-tier valuation limit for agricultural homestead property, and this section would set that first-tier valuation limit at $2.5 million for assessment year 2023, and then beginning in assessment 2024, it would then be, annually adjusted by the Commission Revenue pursuant to current law.
Mr. Swanson.
Section 12 of the House bill is another conforming change related to the changes that are in Section 21. This particular change relates to the manufactured home park classification changes that are in Section 21. Again, this is just a conforming piece that will go along with that. Sections 13 through 19, along with Section 24 in Article 4 of the House bill, are all related to the same provision, and this would allow property owners to qualify for homestead by providing an individual tax identification number, or ITIN. Section 18, which again contains one of those conforming changes to the ITIN provision, contains one additional change. So Section 18 would also add grandparent, step-parent, uncle, aunt, nephew, and niece to the list of qualifying relatives who can be actively farming an agricultural property in order for that owner for the owner of that property to qualify for the special ag homestead treatment.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, Senate Article 4, Sections 7 and 8, all concern Class 4D low-income rental housing. Section 4 requires that property owner receive approval by the governing body of the city or town where the property is located for initial Class 4D designation for property that was not in whole or in part classified as Class 4D prior to assessment year 2023. And the language is written such that a property owner that received necessary approval under this section would not be required to seek approval prior to applying in any subsequent year. And Section 8 is a conforming change that would include that approval requirement onto the actual application that is submitted by the property owner to the Housing Finance Agency for Class 4D certification. Senate Article 4, Section 9 establishes a new affordable housing market value exclusion program. Eligible properties would be entitled to receive a 50% market value exclusion. An eligible property is defined as one that is classified as Class 4A or 4 plus rental units, is not classified in whole or in part as Class 4D. Construction of the property began on or after January 1st, 2023, and at least 20% of the units are available for residents whose household income at the time of initial occupancy does not include 60% of area median income, and at least 80% of those available units are actually occupied. In addition, this requires that any unoccupied available units be actively marketed towards a person meeting those income requirements. The language requires that a city council, town board, or county board acting on behalf of an unorganized territory must first adopt a resolution agreeing to participate in the program, and then must also adopt a second parcel-specific resolution for each parcel and each property that the local government unit wishes to receive the exclusion. That parcel-specific resolution must then be forwarded to the county board, and the county board must actively approve that in order for the actual property to receive the exclusion. Lastly, Mr. Chair, members, the exclusion program itself would expire December 31st, 2030, so any property that has not received approval by the county board before that time would not be eligible to receive the exclusion. Mr. Chair, Article 4, Section 10 modifies the classification tier rates for Class 1C, commonly referred to as Ma and Pa or Mom and Pop Homestead Resort property. And I will defer to Mr. Swans for the next section.
Because we're only going to have a couple days to kind of put things together, Chair Nelson and myself are going to establish kind of a working group on some of these property tax items, local option sales tax, tax increment financing, 4D, and some of these things that we're seeing members. So we're going to gather a subgroup to be able to work separately on some of these items.
Yes, and then to add, we'll do the same with the local option sales taxes as well.
Yep. Very good. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 20 of Article 4 in the House bill would add industrial hemp to the definition of agricultural products, and this would allow property on which agricultural hemp is grown to qualify for the agricultural classification. Section 21 contains two different changes that I mentioned throughout the overview so far. So the first of these changes is related to manufactured home parks, and this change would create one single classification for manufactured home park property and set the classification rate for this classification at 0.75%. This section would also set the classification rate at 0.75% for any community land trust unit that is owned and used as a homestead by the occupant.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Article 4, Section 11 is another section that relates to Class 4D low-income rental housing properties, and this would set the class rate for those properties at 0.25%.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, moving on to Section 22 of the House bill. This section would change the disabled veterans exclusion application window for spouses of veterans who died due to a service-connected cause and for spouses of veterans who would have been eligible for the 100% exclusion. This section would allow applications within 2 years of the service member's death, within 2 years of the spouse receiving a dependency and indemnity compensation determination, or by December 31st, 2023, whichever is later. Any surviving spouse whose application under either of these provisions had previously been denied could reapply. This section also allows surviving spouses to reapply for the exclusion if they had been receiving the exclusion, but the exclusion expired. And lastly, in the House version of the section, there's a date change which would move the date by which county veteran service officers must certify information to the county assessor.
Mr. Chair and members, the Senate Article 4, Section 12 contains both of the changes concerning the application window extension for surviving spouses, but it does not include the date change relating to certification by the county veteran service officer to the county assessor.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 23 of the House bill increases the value thresholds and the maximum exclusion amount for the homestead market value exclusion. So the House provision would increase the home value that is eligible for the 40% exclusion from $76,000 up to $80,300. And it would also increase the home value at which the exclusion is fully phased out from $413,800 to $437,100.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Article 4, Section 13 also relates to the homestead market value exclusion. The Senate proposes to increase by approximately 25% both the minimum and the maximum market value thresholds. Under the Senate's proposal, the exclusion would equal 40% of the first $95,000 of market value, and for homesteads valued between $95,000 and $517,200, the exclusion would equal $38,000 minus 9% of the value over $95,000. Likewise, the Senate would also increase the maximum valuation threshold so that homesteads valued at $517,200 or more would not be eligible for the exclusion. Section 14 also relates to the affordable housing market value exclusion I previously discussed in Senate Article 4, Section 9. This would actually authorize those eligible properties to receive the exclusion.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 24 of the House bill is another conforming change related to the ITIN provision. Section 25 increases the school building bond agricultural credit to 85%, beginning with property taxes payable in 2024. Section 26 of the House bill specifies that attachments and appurtenances to distribution line property owned by utility cooperatives include metering equipment, streetlights, and any other infrastructure that is physically or electrically connected to the cooperative association's distribution system.
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Article 4, Section 15 also provides a definition for attachments and appurtenances. Slightly different, however, the Senate's definition would include but not be limited to all cooperative association-owned metering and streetlight equipment that is physically or electrically connected to the cooperative association distribution system. Section 16 makes changes to the state general levy or state general tax. This proposal would reduce both the CI levy and seasonal rec levy by a combined $23 million for taxes payable in 2023 through 2025. And then beginning with taxes payable in 2026, the levies for both CI and seasonal rec properties would be reduced by 10% each year until the levies are zero and it's repealed for taxes payable in 2035. Section 17 would add the affordable housing market value exclusion I previously discussed in Section 9 and the agricultural riparian buffer credit that Mr. Arneson will talk about in a few minutes to the property tax statement.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Sections 27 and 28 of the House bill would remove the 10% minimum interest rate on delinquent property taxes and on the unpaid balance of any contract repurchase tax forfeited property. These two sections would also allow counties for both of these purposes to establish interest rates lower than the prime rate charged by banks, again, for each of these situations.
Mr. Sylvia.
And Mr. Chair, members, Senate Article 4, Section 18, 19, they're identical to the provisions Mr. Swanson just discussed. Section 20 of the Senate bill makes changes to the additional or targeting property tax refund. This section reduces from 12 to 10% the threshold to qualify for the refund and also increases from $1,000 to $2,000 the maximum refund allowed. And it appears that would be the same as carried in House Article 10, Section 9.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 29 of the House property tax article is another conforming change related to the community land trust provision in Section 21. So this section would just ensure that a taxpayer is eligible for property tax refunds if they reside in a community land trust property that's receiving the 4D classification. Sections 30 through 33 of the House property tax article would increase the household income limit for the senior citizens property tax deferral program from $60,000 up to $96,000. These sections would also reduce the from 15 years to 5 years the minimum occupancy requirement for homeowners in order to qualify for the program.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Article 4, Sections 21 through 24 also relate to the senior citizen property tax deferral program. The Senate also reduces from 15 to 5 the owner and occupancy requirement, but increases from 60 to 75,000 the household income limit as opposed to 60 to 96,000 as contained in the House proposal. Senate Article 4, Section 25 exempts bonds issued to finance the construction of or to repay a loan for a public safety building from counting towards the debt limit of the City of Virginia. And the difference between this and House Article 10, Section 28 is the effective date. The Senate proposes to provide that exemption effective date following final enactment, and the House would require local approval for that to become effective.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, members, Sections 35 and 36 of the House bill would request the legislative auditor to conduct a special review of costs to counties for the provision of child protective services. Included in this review would be an overview of the amount each county paid for child protective services using property tax revenues. And finally, Section 37 of Article 4 in the House bill is another conforming change related to the manufactured home park classification changes in Section 21. Mr. Chair, that concludes the property tax article.
Ms. Swanson, Mr. Sylvia, thank you so much. Questions? Senator Rest.
Just very briefly, author questions. Community Land Trust, whose bill is that in the House?
I believe that's Representative Richardson's. Yeah. Representative Richardson.
Richardson, okay.
Yeah.
And the special review by the legislative auditor of the Child Protection Cost Study.
Senator Rest, that is my bill.
Oh, and it, good. I like
fine
it.
Fine bill. Very bill. Great bill.
Particularly since you pay for it.
She picks out the great bill.
I tell you.
She's got a
Senator Rest, any further questions?
No, that answers my questions. Thank you, sir.
Representative Davids.
This is for the Department, Ms. Bears, on Article 4, Section 26, and it's similar to the Senate Section 15. We had testimony that after 80 years out of the clear blue, the department started taxing our rural electric cooperatives on their metering equipment and so forth. Let's say a bill just didn't happen to make it this year. Would you continue to tax those the infrastructure, even though it hasn't been taxed for 80 years? Or do we really need to lock this thing down quick? And I mean, that, what a money grab that's been for the department. Out of the clear blue, you just made it up. What happens with that if there's no tax bill?
Who would like, Ms. Bears or Mr. Wilson? Oh. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Clockstein. I'm an assistant director at the Department of Revenue. Representative Davids. So first of all, there's the technical definition of what an appurtenance and attachment is. And the department has been pretty clear with what that is in our guidelines and our memos and all the publications that we have. When we find out that they are not reporting these items correctly, then we look into it and we clarify with them and we provide them education. And so something that has been done for a long time maybe should have been looked into a little bit earlier.
Well, Mr.
Representative
Chair,
Davids.
That's not acceptable. I mean, changing the rules after 80 years and calling it education and raising the rates on all the rural electric cooperative members is not acceptable to me. And obviously you can see from Section 26 and Section 15 of the Senate, it's not acceptable to us either. I think we need to give you an education, and you need to reconsider what you're doing after 80 years of doing it one way, and then all of a sudden sending them huge tax bills for a whole lot of appurtenances. That's just wrong, and I would hope that regardless of what happens with the tax bill here, that you reverse your decision on that issue.
Mr. Glockseam, anything further on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Davids, the department is not opposed to this clarifying language, and we will work with the companies if we do get it.
So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Nelson.
Yeah, And so that is the question. If clarifying language is needed, we just need to know about it. You know, put it in the policy bill, which is usually a bipartisan, non-controversial bill that gets done. So I think that would be incredibly a much better solution than the path that you've started here right now.
Mr. Chair, so and Chair Mr. Nelson, Lakshi, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other? Senator Bach.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm just curious if this provision scores as a cost on the spreadsheet.
It does, I know. Ms. Templin. Ms. Schill?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
Yes, on the part on attachments and appurtenances on the sales tax exemption, what is the revenue estimate on that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, look on lines 25 and 26. So that's at the bottom of page 7, and then it continues on to page 8. And there is, on the spreadsheet, there is just a timing difference. And the definition, yes, I asked Department of Revenue, the difference between the $520,000 in fiscal 25 that the House is carrying compared to the...
Ms. Schill, I think that's, you're referring to the wrong one. We're looking at, let's see here. It's up in the sales tax area. Appurtenances, let's see.
Attachments and appurtenances.
Yes.
Utility cooperatives, including metering equipment. So we're looking at Section 26 of Article 4 and Section 15 of the Senate bill. The difference is, look on line... four of the summary where it talks about and any other infrastructure that is physically or electrically connected to the cooperative association's distribution equipment, that therein lies the difference in the cost.
Thank you, Ms. Schiff. I don't think we're still on the right one.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Weber,
we're talking about the cooperative taxing situation here, and I believe her items concerning the House provision on line 25 and the Senate provision on line 26 are indeed those items.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Weber, yes, because I inquired with the Department of Revenue when the difference between the two items came up in the tracking. And the interpretation by the Department of Revenue, and I'll pull up the revenue estimate in just a moment, they pointed me to what could possibly be connected in that other infrastructure category is where the cost difference lies. And I will provide to the committee the revenue estimate, if that is helpful.
Yes, no, thank you. That is line 25. I was thinking of the conduit. I had that mixed up in my mind. It looks like $520,000 is what.
Right, and there's a difference between $500,000 in the scoring of the provision, and it's tied to that other infrastructure component.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, my point for raising it is, this hasn't been taxed, and now the department changes their position and decides it's going to be taxed. And because they changed their position, it scores as a cost. I don't understand how that works. If we didn't have this in here, could we score $520,000 of revenue?
Mr. Swanson, I see you dared raise your hand to get into here. So, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Baca, you know, I think the issue here is just the language that is used in both of these sections between the House and the Senate bill. It's my understanding that the bills in both bodies are kind of attempting to accomplish the same thing, but the wording that's used in the House bill, there's some concern that it might include some language that is currently taxable, like substations, distribution lines, things like that. So that you know, things that are currently taxable and under current law might get looped in under the House language as exempt.
Okay, thank you. Senator Bach. So the idea is there might be some things that could be included taxable in the House language that is not in the Senate language.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Bach?
No, that's fine.
Anyone else?
Well, I just don't think this is clear yet. I don't think that, in my mind, the question is not the difference between the House and the Senate. The question is, how can it be that these are being taxed now and they haven't been for decades? That's the question. We haven't changed tax policy regarding this. And I just want to know, how can it be that there's suddenly a new tax on these things? Where did that come from? What authority, whose authority brought forth a new tax on things that have not been taxed before? Mm-hmm. What's the authority that would allow that to happen? I think it's the legislature.
Madam Chair, Chair Marquardt and Chair Nelson. So I will give you an example of how this happened. We had a utility that was reporting and paying on these items, and they were very clearly stated out as what they were according to our reporting. And then they were purchased by several cooperative utilities. And then when they did that, all these items that were reported a certain way, not included in attachments and appurtenances, disappeared. So they just became exempt like that. Well, when that something like that happens, the department looks into it, obviously. And so that's where we discovered that, you know, how the cooperative utilities are throwing these things in the bucket needs a little bit more scrutiny. And the department, it was happy to do that.
Okay. So we got it here. So, you know, let's see if we can clarify this. So thank you very much. Anything else on Article 4? Questions from members? All
Mr.
right.
Mr. Chair,
Michelle?
If it's helpful, I do have the revenue estimate, and the definition included under the proposal for the House defines attachments and appurtenances to include all cooperative association metering equipment, street lights, and any other infrastructure that is physically or electrically connected to the cooperative's distribution system. And so the expansiveness of the language used is what triggers this.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Appreciate that. All right. Article 5 in both the House and the Senate, state aids and property tax aids and credit. Mr. Swanson and Mr. Arneson, welcome.
Mr. Chair and members, this is the property tax aids and credits article. The first section appears on the Senate side of the summary. The Senate proposes to establish an agricultural riparian buffer credit. This would be a credit available to owners of Class 2A and 2B land that is required to be, a portion of which is required to be maintained as a riparian protection buffer. Land enrolled in CRP or other easement programs would not be eligible to generate the credit. The credit amount would be equal to the net tax capacity-based property tax attributable to the portion of the property that is required to be maintained as a buffer. And the section appropriates money to revenue and Commissioner of Education to pay the credit amounts. As Mr. Wilms earlier indicated, the estimate indicates that about 430,000 acres of land would be eligible for the credit of the roughly 700,000 acres of buffer in the state. Section 2 is kind of a technical addition, adding the buffer property tax credit and the electric generation transition aid to the list of school district reimbursable aids and credits. So I'll talk about the electric generation transition aid later. Section 3 on the Senate side adds the buffer credit to the list of credits used to calculate net property tax. Section 4 on the Senate side adds the buffer credit to the items required to be listed separately on the proposed property tax statement.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, sections 1 through 9, along with section 16, 19, and 24 of Article 5 of the House bill, all make changes to the city local government aid program. These changes include new need formula factors within the LGA calculation, the elimination of certified aid adjustments in the LGA formula, the elimination of sparsity adjustments within the LGA formula, and an overall increase in the LGA appropriation of about $34.2 million. Moving on to Section 10 of Article 5 in the House bill. Section 10 increases the county program aid appropriation by $13 million annually. Sections 11, 12, and 13 are all PILT-related provisions in the House Article 5. So Section 11 increases PILT payment amounts from $2 per acre up to $3 per acre for other natural resources land that is administered by the county and other natural resources land that is administered by the Department of Natural Resources. This section also creates an additional PILT payment amount for counties with high proportions of PILT eligible lands. Section 12 of Article 5 prevents the appraised value of acquired natural resources land from decreasing from one appraisal to the next. And Section 13 of Article 5 indexes to inflation the per acre PILT payment rates. Section 14 of Article 5 in the House bill establishes a new state aid program that would distribute $22 million annually to soil and water conservation districts. Of this amount, 70% would be distributed equally among all districts, and 30% would be distributed according to each district's proportional share of non-public land.
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 5 on the Senate side proposes a new electric generation transition aid. This transition aid would be available to certain counties, cities, towns, and school districts that lose a substantial amount of tax base when an electric generating unit is retired. The language provides a formula to calculate the initial aid amount, which is roughly equal to the amount of tax base that that disappears when the unit is retired. And then that initial aid amount is phased out over a period of 20 years. The language also establishes some additional criteria for determining whether to eliminate aid to that taxing jurisdiction before the end of the 20-year phase-out period. And it makes certain prior unit retirements retroactively eligible for aid.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 15 of Article 5 in the House bill makes a change to the local homeless prevention aid. So this change would route 11% of the overall annual appropriation to the aid to the 11 tribal governments in the state. This section would also require each county to send any unspent aid to the continuum of care of which the county is a part of. Section 16, again, is another change related to the LGA changes that I mentioned earlier. Section 17 of Article 5 establishes a new state aid to counties and cities for the funding of qualifying affordable housing projects. The section would distribute $32 million annually to counties and $8 million to cities. Section 18 of the House bill replaces the current local performance measurement program with a new, stronger community aid program. Counties and cities could elect to participate in the program, and they would select and evaluate performance measures annually. Section 19 is another change related to the LGA changes. Section 20 establishes a one-time appropriation of $40 million to counties to establish or support a community career workforce academy. Section 21 is another PILT-related provision that requires the Commissioner of Revenue in consultation with the DNR and counties to produce a report on the valuation methods used to value acreage and shoreline areas within natural resources land.
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair, members, Section 6 on the Senate side proposes a reimbursement to taxing jurisdictions in Mille Lacs County for lost property tax revenue due to the placement of a certain property into trust by the United States Department of Interior Bureau of Indian Affairs. The eligibility would run from those properties placed into trust from January 1, 2009 through June 30, 2021. The initial reimbursement aid amount would continue for 5 years and then beginning in the sixth year start to phase out. Section 7 proposes a Class 40 transition aid for 2 years only for 2024. This relates to the 4D policy changes that Mr. Sylvia described earlier. This aid would be available to approximately 39 cities, and the aid amount would be a function of the city's pay 23 tax rate and an approximation of the net tax capacity reduced from 4D properties as a result of the classification rate changes. Section 8 proposes to forgive the 2019 LGA penalty for the city of Roosevelt. Section 9 proposes to forgive the pay 21 aid penalty for the city of Bena for its withheld LGA and small cities assistance aid amounts. Section 10 similarly proposes to forgive the 2021 aid penalty amount for the city of Boy River for its withheld LGA and small cities assistance amounts. And the next two sections are the same in both bodies and propose 2021 aid penalty forgiveness for the cities of Echo and Morton for those cities withheld pay 21 LGA and small cities assistance amounts.
Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, finally, Section 24 of Article 5 in the House bill makes a couple of conforming changes related to the LGA provision and the stronger community aid provision that I covered earlier. This section just repeals a few outdated sections and statute that would no longer be needed with the changes in those other sections. Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 5.
Thank you, Ms. Swanson, Mr. Arneson. That completes Article 5. Questions, members? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just the author of Section 21. I may follow up separately. Study of state-owned lakeshore.
That is Representative Eklund, Bill. It was part of the PILT changes in increase, but it's Representative Eklund.
Okay, thank you.
Senator, and then I think Senator Bach probably was the author in the Senate. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a few quick questions on bills we didn't either get into our committee until after deadline. And just some quick questions on the fiscal notes. So Roosevelt, Bena, and Boy River, we didn't get bills in time to hear. And is my understanding, just so I know for sure, Roosevelt is the only one that has a cost because the money was already canceled back to the general fund. Is that accurate?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, members, that's accurate. The only one of these five penalty forgiveness provisions in either body that would score a cost on the spreadsheet would be this Roosevelt one, because the 2019 aids had been canceled back previously.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the other question I had actually was about the electrical generation transition aid.
Which section?
What section was it? Electrical generation transition aid was section...
Section 5.
Section article. 5 of the Senate bill. I know on the spreadsheet it said $5.2 million for 2425, but it also had a notation. I'm trying to remember, since it phases out by 20 years, is that $5.2 million every biennium, or does that increase?
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Joachim, the spreadsheet indicates that in the first year that the cost is that $5.2 million. I think we would expect that as additional units are retired, especially when units are retired in taxing jurisdictions in which the unit itself or the total plant makes up a very substantial portion of the local tax base. You know, the costs would be greater in the first years of those kinds of retirements. You know, for example, members may know that in the city of Becker, the plant there, I think, constitutes roughly 70-75% of the net tax capacity of the city itself, and a very substantial portion of the school district tax base. So, when those units were retired and become first eligible, and those taxing jurisdictions become first eligible for aid, you know, the aid amounts in those first years of the long phase-out period would be somewhat greater.
Representative Joaquin.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And yeah, I know the city of Becker's done a wonderful job trying to replace that value as well, and I give them credit for that. They really were working hard. One last question on that. I can't remember from the language. Is it until it's replaced at 80%, or is it 100% of the cost?
Mr. Arneson.
Mr. Chair, members, if members have the Senate bill in front of them, they could refer to page 102, subdivision 5, aid elimination, and the Representative Joachim, I think, was recalling that when the NTC of the taxing jurisdiction rebounds to some certain level, that the aid is eliminated, and the threshold there in the text at 102.18 yeah. is 90% of the jurisdiction's total net tax capacity in the assessment year preceding the aid calculation year in which the jurisdiction first qualified for aid. So, if the taxing jurisdiction's NTC was at least 90%, you know, kind of adjusted for inflation relative to the point, relative to the NTC calculated in the year before the unit went offline, then the aid for that taxing jurisdiction for that unit would be eliminated.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anything else on Article 5? If not, we're going to move to Article 6, which is Article 8 in the Senate, Tax Increment Financing. So we have Mr. Cope is virtual and Mr. Sylvia. So, Mr. Cope.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Sections 1 through 11 of the House side all have same and similar provisions in the Senate TIF article. These came from the bill brought by the Office of the State Auditor. Section 1 expands the definition of administrative costs for the purposes of tax increment financing to list expenses which qualify as administrative. Section 2 adds a definition of pay-as-you-go contracts and notes, which is a contract in which the authority commits to using tax increment to reimburse a developer, property holder, or other note holder, and where that party bears the risk that tax increment may be insufficient to cover the cost of reimbursement. Section 3 clarifies a limitation on administrative expenses, and for the purposes of calculating the allowable amount of administrative expenses, it excludes from that calculation of total tax increment amounts paid to the county auditor either as excess increment or as remedies for unlawfully including or keeping a property in a TIF district. It also exempts expenditures on maintaining property purchased by the authority using the increment from caps on administrative expenses. And the Senate version is similar, except that it also excludes returned increment paid to the county auditor after decertification. Section 4 adds the payment of administrative expenses to the list of purposes for which tax increment financing revenue can be used.
Mr. Sylvia.
Mr. Chair, members, just wanted to comment on the difference that appears in Senate Article 8, Section 3, and House Article 6, Section 3 as well. As Mr. Cope indicated, these sections are all from the state auditor's policy and technical bill. It's my understanding that the additional cross-reference that is noted in Senate Article 8, Section 3 was included, but at that time the House, I believe, had already acted on this proposal and therefore did not include that section, but I believe the Senate did not act and include that on its own. It did come from the state auditor as a technical correction via an amendment, so I think that's why, other than that, the language is identical, but for that additional cross-reference, and that's noted in the Senate column.
Very good. Section 5?
Mr. Chair and members, Senate Article 8, Section 5 relates to economic development districts, and this section would allow increment generated from these types of districts to be spent on a multi-level commercial facility in a small city, provided that the square feet of the facility does not exceed 15,000 square feet. Under current law, the limitation would apply to the entire commercial facility, and the Senate is specifying that for purposes of economic development district increment in a small city, if the commercial facility is a multi-level facility, then that 15,000 square feet limitation would apply to the first floor only. And for purposes of this section, first floor is defined as the floor at street level.
Mr. Copes, Section 5 on the House side.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 5 of Article 6 on the House side exempts certain amounts paid to the county auditor from counting towards total revenue derived from the district for the purposes of pooling limits. And it deems certain other expenses paid to the county auditor as expenditures within the district for the purposes of pooling limits. Section 6 of Article 6 of the House bill makes some technical corrections and cleaning up the language of the five-year rule, and it removes an obsolete reference. Section 7 of Article 6 of the House bill provides new rules for decertification of a district and for a deferral of decertification for districts that have outstanding pay-as-you-go notes. Section 8 of Article 6 corrects a formula for calculating the deficit of a district. Section 9 of Article 6 removes an exception for failure to certify from requirement that the authority has to pay to the county auditor the amount generated from a property which was unlawfully included or kept in a tax increment financing district. Section 10 of Article 6 makes a clarifying change regarding the county auditor's withholding increments from authorities that fail to comply with their annual reporting requirements. Section 11 of Article 6 expands the sources of permitted purposes of TIF expenditures from Minnesota Statute Section 469.176 to include the entirety of Chapter 469, which deals with tax increment financing, and that runs from 469.174 through 469.1794.
Very good. We're going to stop at this point. So thank you, Mr. Cope. Thank you, Mr. Sylvia. Madam Chair, what are we doing tomorrow?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to thank our staffs for doing such a remarkable job. And I think Mr. Sylvia would have said the Senate positions were the same on those that we just went through. Mr. Chair, tomorrow we're going to pick up where we left off here on page 41, or which would be Article 6, Section 12, where we start getting into those individual TIF proposals. And then we will go through the other remaining articles, which would end it with Article 13. But we can take heart. Those articles are a bit smaller and less dense than the ones we went through tonight. So tomorrow we will finish our bit of a walkthrough, and then my hope is that we will also do same and similars that do not have any costs attached. So we can go through that and then maybe take a recess as we might prepare some offers. Again, the clock is ticking. I know we have a lot of good work to do, so that would be my intention.
Thank you very much, Chair Nelson, and also thank you to the staff for the wonderful presentation and all the work. Thank you, members. Members, please leave your binders here. unless you want to be one of those students who want to look ahead always, you know. I suppose you could take, yes, Representative Davids, I know you want to take this home and read ahead. But anyway, leave this here, but take everything else with you. So member,
what time do we meet?
Oh, 9 o'clock.
So can we leave our laptops here?
Can we? I don't know about that for sure, Senator Gazelka. I don't know what the criteria is. I would take your laptops just to be safe. So thank you for your work tonight. And with that, we are adjourned.